This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
What is up, everybody? Hope you're having a fantastic day whenever you happen to be listening to this show. The podcast, of course, you could be listening to it on Friday or Saturday or Sunday or even like 6 months from now. It does always amaze me when I see people like, I'm getting caught up in the last 3 weeks, which is awesome. So thanks. Hope you're having a fantastic day. We've got a great show for you to enjoy in your ears. My name is Garnet Lee, and returning back triumphantly at the other end of the table is Indie Jeff Mattis.
Yes, I am here. It's great to be back, really. Seriously.
Awesome to have you on. Hopefully the first of many upcoming appearances for Jeff. And Andrew Yoon is also here.
Howdy.
And then we have the empty chair.
Yeah. It's empty.
I told you it's that Kickstarter money.
I wish we had a cricket sound to play right now.
He's off gallivanting.
Yeah, he is. He's off spending that money.
He's actually on the way here. Jeff Cannata on his way here.
But he's probably coming here on an Uber on top of a unicorn on top of
a chariot driven by. Yeah, exactly.
On his way to the studio from Los Angeles International Airport. So he will be here hopefully within the next segment or two. We are going to roll right ahead anyway. We've got a great show for you. Like I was saying, we've got all kinds of stuff, including games like and including Luigi's Mansion. Jeff Cannata also did read the boards enough and has played. Is that Miasmata?
Miasmata, yes.
Miasmata, which was a game that was very heartily recommended across the interwebs to us for the exploration game that fit the fancy of...
And perhaps the best in-game cartography system ever.
Hey, let's hear it for map making.
Well, no, it's interesting, though.
So that we got some Gears of War.
Interesting, yeah.
Got some Gods of War because Jeff Mattis is playing Gods of War.
Yes, I am.
And what else we got up in here? We'll come back to the Tomb Raider subject a little bit. I mean, I feel like we talked about Tomb Raider a good bit.
We should
bit.
Also talk about Metro.
We've got some great some great feedback from you guys. Metro Last Light, which Andrew Yoon has seen. So, and then we got some news. So we got a lot. We will roll forward. I wanted to kick off with this, which is what we were kicking around here in the studio right before we got on the mics, which is Cart Life.
Yes.
I didn't even realize it was out yet, but I remember seeing it a while back ago at an indie... I want to say maybe Indiecade.
Yeah, and he's had a freeware version online for a bit, but this is the Steam release just hit. So this is a sort of, slightly more polished version of the game. But it's
but still a cool indie game called Cart Life up on Steam. And the pitch is...
You are running a food cart or newsstand or some similar sort of...
And then life happens.
And then life happens.
Okay,
yes.
So actually, why don't you start and then maybe I'll interrupt you with life.
Okay, sure. So the gist of the game is you are in a city. You start off by picking a character, and the cast of characters that they give you to choose from are pretty interesting and diverse and not typical video game characters. So the guy that I selected is this guy... I think his name's Andreas, and he's
Andreas, something like that. Yeah. I'm like, that sounds like my name. I'll play with him.
He's from the Ukraine, and basically, you read his little bio, and it's like, okay, he's starting a newsstand, and he can work long hours because he's got a great work ethic, but he also smokes, so he'll occasionally need cigarettes and nicotine, and he'll and it's basically you get dumped in this city. It's got these really cool sort of transitional animatics that are all it's all this grayscale, black and white, 8-bit. Art style that's fantastic.
Andrew's also taught himself English by translating poetry.
That's true, which he does on the train to, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's
a lot. Already love the way you're like having these anecdotes. Like.
Yeah, a lot of interesting flavor to these things. But really, it's like, you wake up in the morning and Andres or whatever his name is has a cat. So one of the first things you do when you get into town is he's got his cat and his cat carrier and has to find a motel to live in. And you get to the motel and you check in and they're like, okay, well, this is how much rent is for a week and oh, no pets. And so, you bring your cat in anyway. And one of the first things you got to do is find him cat food and then go work your newsstand. And, it's.
Couldn't you just much more easily like throw the cat in the Hudson?
Yeah, but that's not cool. That's mean.
Well, and yeah, you're really just mean. you're just a jerk, really. I mean, it's like the American dream, the game. You know, Andrew specifically, he's looking for a new life in America. He comes in with like $2,200 right. in his pocket. And on the first day, he spends $2,000 buying the new stand.
The stand, yeah.
And then $187 on the first week of rent. So you really only have like $13. So it hits you hard right at the get-go. You're like, yeah. Wow, I am poor. And like the first time you realize how tight money is going to be is when they give you the transportation options
right.
to move anywhere.
So bus, it's like, car, or walk.
It's like, you know, oh, you know, the taxi will, you know, cost $15, but it'll get you there soon. It's like, but then maybe I won't be able to eat.
Or get home before I pass
out. So I remember the first time I'm like, all right, okay, maybe I'll just walk home, you know, yeah. see if that was not a good idea.
Did you get mugged?
No, I didn't get mugged, but I started eating myself. So,
oh, what? You did? You started eating yourself?
No, well, the animation looks like I'm eating, because he was just getting so hungry.
It gives you these little cues, right? You're like, oh, I'm getting hungry, right? And then it'll give you like a full screen animatic of him going, oh, God, I'm getting really hungry and must eat, you know, all this crazy, like, abstract, like, you're getting really hungry. And you guys starting to move a little slower.
Yeah, by the end of my first day, I was broke. I decided to get just drunk in the bar. I had like
just like real life.
Yeah, I fucked up my first transaction with my customer because I had no idea how the system worked. It's like I was selling a newspaper for 49 cents, which by the way is not a good price.
No.
So, you really have to jack it up because I'm like, oh, he handed me a $20 bill. Oh shit, $10, $5, and the customer's patience goes. He's like, fuck this, and I'm like, no, but I need your 49 cents. How am I gonna eat? And then the cigarette like addiction kicks in and he's just getting really grumpy and I'm like, I can't deal with this. I'm like
your cat's starving in your apartment because you didn't go to the different part of town and get cat food for it. And
then if you go to a different part of town, you know, you might have to walk there because you don't want to pay for bus fare.
Right.
It all adds up.
Could you eat the cat?
No.
You are a dark person.
he's like your best friend. He's like your only friend.
Yeah, he's the only thing you live for, and you want to take that away from him.
Granted, he is a big, like, money suckhole, but I mean, when you only got a couple bucks. But the game is really, really interesting because it blends all these really strange mechanical things. So there's stuff where you're actually navigating your character around, but, like, when you open your newsstand, one of the first things you do is you get the shipment of papers, and you got to stock your newsstand. So the way you do that is you're like, click a button, it starts the stocking process, and then it gives you a list of phrases, which you actually have to type. So stocking the papers, period, and type it correctly. And if you type it wrong and hit enter, he rips one of the papers. And if you're like folding the papers.
What, there's like a typing of the dead part?
There's like a typing
of
the dead.
It's essentially, and the great thing is it's really repetitive. So it really gives you that feeling of like how mundane the job is.
Right. So you have to do stocking the papers, period.
Yeah. Period, enter, stocking the papers period.
Make a nice crease, period.
Yeah, like, still doing this, period.
Right, and then you stock the papers and then you actually have a mini game where you're selling stuff to people and it's like you have to figure out the change.
I'm simultaneously freaked out by this whole thing. I mean, just hold on before you get to the change thing. I'm simultaneously freaked out by how well that translates the idea of something totally menial and by even thinking that would be a game. Because it's like, it is a weird, like, putting yourself through a menial task version and then saying, oh, it's a game.
I had a really weird, playing this game is very strange because you do have that sort of intellectual moment where you're like, wow, this is fun. Like you're thinking to yourself and you're like, yeah, you know, it actually is fun. And it's making me think about, you know, things beyond, I got to run through this really pretty environment and kill everyone. It's like, it's a simulation with all this tongue in cheek and really sort of dark, but still upbeat because of the art style tropes and stuff. It's just, it's really,
I mean,
really cool.
I really want these characters to survive, you know,
yes.
And it's so frustrating that it's so difficult.
So each of them, I guess, has a different story.
Yeah. So you have like a single mom who has to raise a certain amount of money for her to get child custody, and one of her things, her little setback, she has to pick up her kid from school every week or every day, rather,
at 3 p.m.
At 3 p.m. So it's like you have to manage that. There's a guy who like drinks tons of caffeine, so you can walk like to different places a lot faster. So if you're about big about foot transpo, you can, but he needs caffeine. So it's like the cigarette guy, you know, if you don't give him his caffeine, he'll start slowing down and underperforming. You can't even, if you go to a store and your mood is terrible, either you're too hungry or whatever, you can't actually, there are conversation options, so you can have small talk. But if you're too hungry, you can't do small talk. You're just like straight to business.
And, I am hungry. Give me sandwich.
Yeah, yeah, no, it. I remember when my first day operating the shop, I'm like, oh, hi, I'm such and such. What's your name? And then just towards the end of the day, I'm like, yeah, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Give me money.
You want a copy of the paper? Here.
But it's so frustrating, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, man, but I do want to, like, figure out how to, like, make these people's lives better, right, and, like, expand their empire by you know, a stand in a better part of the city and start selling artisanal, hand-grown ground coffee with, the hand-picked herbs.
It is surprisingly deep. Like, you go to a grocery store, and there's a bunch of stuff in there, items you can buy where you're like, initially, you're like, what the hell can I do with all this stuff? Like,
so it goes far. I mean, although it might be called cart life, it goes well beyond that.
Life is the key.
Yeah,
word
life, more life, less cart.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a very cool, like, indie movie idea, right? It sounds like a very cool indie movie. One of the later, you know, like the, you know, the generation of mumble cores. And
but you could totally really, really, it is depressing, though. I mean, we are talking about it quite favorably, but you will feel
like
shit.
Have you watched any of those indie movies? Most of them are like they're like the person who's, you know, mid-20-somethings, out of college, doesn't know what to do, and is sort of stumbling around in life. It's become a very interesting genre in indie film.
And this, you know, this obviously is not a game for everybody. If you are the kind of gamer that is akin to the kind of movie watcher that's like, what, subtitles? I don't like reading in my movies. Then you're not going to probably like it. But if you're willing to invest and you're willing to, you know, it is presentationally very attractive despite being 8-bit. You know, it's like that. And that part.
And grayscale.
And that's part of what keeps it. I mean, it could have been a lot more oppressive feeling than it already is, even though it is incredibly oppressive. It has this the art kind of does a counterpoint with its depressing motif. So it's like,
what's interesting to me isn't the game in and of itself. It's those parts that you were talking about with, like, the typing and relating a menial task and how they interpret, how they take something that the designer wants you to feel, experience in the way the character would, and translates it into something that you have to do that communicates that. You started to talk after so we first were talking about, like, stocking, and then you were, like, moving on to talking about making change and selling stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's another mind-bogglingly stressful video mini game because you're, like, you know, you see how much they give you, so they throw down a bill, and you're looking at your change drawer, and you actually have to select individual pieces of change and individual bills to make the proper change before your customer gets fed up and just takes off. So it's really not – I mean, it's some basic math and stuff, but when you first look at it, the interface maybe might throw you for a loop a little bit.
Well, yeah, because they don't teach you anything.
No, and that's the other thing is you will – probably your first run, you'll be like, oh, man, okay, so, like, I probably should have, you know – gotten cat food for my cat on the first day or second day.
Because the cat died?
Actually, no. I got to a point where the cat was getting really hungry, and I was like, oh, shit.
Does the cat eat you?
No.
This is a realistic game, all right?
Garnett's got this cat thing, you know. Obviously, he's got some personal experience that traumatized him.
I've been living with the cats by myself for this week. It's like...
yeah, no, this is not
I'm
the
possessed
cat,
now.
The cat barbecue game. No.
But I mean, you know, it's easy to recommend just because it is free, you know.
It's free even on Steam.
It's $5 on Steam, which includes the third character.
It might still be on sale if you get it quick. I don't know. I got it for like $3.50, the Steam version. I played the freeware. It's worth $3.50.
But yeah, there is a freeware version which only includes the two of the characters. But other than that, and, you know, if you're interested, you know, just
yeah. You know what I want to say? If you have Steam and you can support this, and you get an extra character, and buying it through Steam is so simple. That sounds like a pretty easy decision.
It's great. Now I'm really, really glad to see, because I got a chance to talk to Richard Hoffmeyer, the guy that made the game, and he is very much the indie auteur sort of.
Cool.
By himself. I mean, he's got some help from his girlfriend, I think, but, like, he is a very much a solo one man team doing this stuff, and it's very evident because it's not just I want to copy of it. It's like he's designing really cool stuff, like that, you know, that typing mechanic makes you feel oppressed.
Yeah, I love that from a design idea. I love this idea of, like, figuring out ways to get the player to experience things that they wanted the character to feel. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That is really, really cool.
So if you're you know, maybe burned out with the regular, you know,
even, or if you're too happy.
If you need some emo in your life, you know.
If your life is just too happy,
Just yeah.
It's, I mean, if you don't want one of the GOW games of the month,
right? Right. Yes. If cover based shooter du jour is not your thing,
or if you know Fury Basher,
yeah.
Wait. Incidentally, Furies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Greek Furies.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Capital F.
Cap. I'm there. Yeah.
So actually, we got a rather heartily corrected last week for me walking across the freeway based off having watched Adam Sessler's review of God of War, and I thought that I was pretty upfront about the fact that I had only watched the review and had some concerns based off of, look, I've known Adam for years, and the gravity with which he approached the situation made it seem very very seriously out of whack, and there were a lot of other people who responded, and now there's been, you know, Marcus. So we got into a conversation last week, Jeff, also about how there's also this sort of undercurrent maybe of people wanting to appear to be intellectual and modernly thinking by jumping on the bandwagon, so to say, of I'm protecting women's rights.
Sure, yeah.
And then, you know, I don't necessarily agree. I think we talked about that last week. I don't necessarily agree with Marcus that if you're not a woman, you can't recognize someone being, abusive or negative or stereotyping. But that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. If we were off base about God of War, which I will again reiterate, I have not played, then I apologize for that. And it doesn't, though, change the gravity of being attentive of any group's rights to not be belittled or subjective to derogatory content in media, period.
Yeah.
So, look, the fact that it came up and obviously caught some people's radar was one thing. And if it was off, I apologize. We'll stand corrected. Jeff, though, has actually played the game.
I have.
Which is kind of what we talk about on here anyway. Whenever we go into politics, it becomes a disaster.
So it's God of War.
Why do you hate women? No, sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, we won't go there. Jesus. We won't go there. No,
any other minority groups you can bring in here?
But it's here's the thing. I'm sort of crawling my way through it. It's not like the past couple of God of Wars where I felt sort of like, okay, I'm going to sit down and have a good 3-hour session. It's like, oh, I'll sit down, I'll play through a puzzle room, and it's pretty, and there's some vistas, and there's some enemies to kill. But it is, it scratches a very familiar itch, and it doesn't really do a whole lot.
Does it scratch it, or did you even have the itch? Because here's the question. Let me throw you out this. Andrew and I were talking about editorial plans couple of 3 weeks ago, and one of the things I thought that was interesting was coming up is that you had both God of War and Gears of War coming out, but they're both not by teams that worked on the franchises that you knew them for.
Wait,
and
Santa Monica didn't work on God of War?
Santa Monica
yeah.
It's not the same team, though. I mean,
The same folks, yeah.
The God of War team changes every game, though.
Okay, the God of War team changes every time. More applicable to the Gear story, where it's people can fly instead of Epic. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, you still have a lot of crossover there. I mean, Epic did a lot of support for people can fly. So, I mean, you're right. So how about this? It's been another turnover of people in studios. These are both not core games to what we thought of as the core structure. Is it back? So my main thing was like, is it back to the well one too many times? I mean, like, are these attempts to go back to the well one too many times?
I've had several gaming experiences, including God of War Ascension lately, that have felt like there is a sort of burnout, a level of burnout with these, you know, the same sort of mechanics, the same sort of, you know, there isn't a whole lot of innovation going on, right? You can point to a couple of different mechanical things or whatever. God of War specifically is sort of a problem for me because they decided to plumb this really archaic subset of mythology. So you're like, you know, you hear about this giant, you know, whatever pre-Titan, I don't even remember what they're called, the Hecatoncheles, or you don't even know what the hell these things are, right? And they're huge, and they look really cool when you're fighting them, and they're gigantic. And
so they're like the Titans, but they're not the Titans?
They're like the Titans, but they're not the Titans. And they're even more obscure than the Titans are. So while viscerally, it's like, oh, yeah, all this crazy shit's happening, and it's the God of War action, you don't have that like, oh, dude, I'm fighting Zeus now, or I'm fighting Hermes, or like some sort of god that I like know who he is.
And I think a problem with both of the of War games is that when the marketing machine for the third iteration of both of these franchises were so strong, and you know they're like, come on, finish the fight. Yeah, I'm gonna finish the fight.
Good
and
point.
And you did finish the fight. The games did what the marketing said they would.
And it hasn't been that long.
And then it's like, and hi, we're yeah. coming back. I mean, before, like, it's just a really weird...
With prequels in both cases.
Yeah, well, because there's no way to move forward, really, in either of those franchises, like, you know.
Dude, unless, it's fiction. It's fiction. There's always a way to move forward.
I think unless you do something really drastic, you know.
Some of that has to do with the fact that it's just too close to the last game, I think.
I think so, yeah, because, definitely.
Because, the gameplay itself is still fun. It's still a solid...
That's the other thing is
combo based brawler. Like,
if you hadn't done like God of War 2 and then into God of War 3 and you were like really still feeling the vibe, would this really be satisfying? I heard some stories about like the difficulty being really spiky.
The difficulty primarily for me, the thing that was most noticeable was the QuickTime events. There's less reaction time. I probably died once or twice in combat in the game, but I've died probably, five or six times that amount just because I'm like, oh, I'm sliding down a thing. Oh, there was an X prompt. Hmm. I'm sliding down a thing again. X prompt. Oh, I'm supposed to hit the trigger.
But come on. It's been like how many years since they made the PlayStation controller? You should know those buttons.
No. I just mean like, how QTEs in general are annoying. The reaction times on these, and maybe it's just because, visually it's so stunning and you're looking at stuff and you're like, and you don't have... They don't do as well as highlighting the icons in your peripheral vision. But whatever the case is, they give you less time to react and I do think
QTEs are sort of counterintuitive to the God of War series where it's like, oh, look how pretty the graphics are. No, don't actually look at it. Look at the center of the screen and look for the button prompt. Actually appreciate the graphics.
And they try to do some stuff with the QTEs to like spiff them up. So like there are a couple of QTEs where you're like tethered to another, like an enemy character somehow, like you're chained to him or whatever. And you're basically... Or you're on the back of some monster, right? And you're stabbing it with button presses. And then you'll see the tail. And it'll, if you're on a scorpion, for example, or a manticore, the giant tail action slows down. You can see it like rear back. And then you dodge out of the way in the middle of this QTE. The tail misses you. And then you keep stabbing again. So it's like.
So the QTEs like translate better into actual gameplay? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's what they're trying to do. Really what it feels like is like. Like I'm on the back of this thing. Oh shit! It's a like I can hit X to stab now or square to stab now. It doesn't really. It's
and
not
still a, being on the back of a manticore fighting. It sounds kind of cool.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's got those.
Is it still? It's still. I mean, still assume it's still this all the same sort of like fixed camera for each area, so you don't get disoriented. Have a really good quick combat system.
Yep.
God of multiple weapons.
I mean, I'd really really liken it to say God of War 3, which probably most people have played.
High praise.
But. So far, it feels like a slightly lesser version of that game, in large part due to the things you're fighting and the storyline super convoluted. And like, I don't even know what the fuck, honestly, when it takes place.
Did you really know what was going on in God of War 3, especially at the end?
Well, I mean, I knew he wanted to kill everyone. now I know he wants to kill everyone, but I don't know like why he wants to kill.
He's
everyone.
An angry man. He's a He's very, just, very angry man.
He needs some.
He's one of the angriest men I've ever met.
Yeah.
I mean, I do wonder if they're going to continue with Kratos' story in the next generation. You know, for me, when they did God of War 3 and they sort of closed that story, I'm like, oh, man, it would be so great to, like, continue the franchise, but in a completely different setting or, completely different character.
You know what I would do, which they will never do, is make a new game that is maybe based in mythology, whatever, same sort of world, but... mid-game or end-game, you reveal, oh, Kratos is, like, the god of war in this world and tie it in that way. So you're like, holy shit, this is great fan service.
I feel like God of War 1 actually did have, like, a flash-forward into the future where Kratos is the god of war. Like,
he's on the throne for a minute at the end and, like, the beginning of the second one, too.
Like, I feel like there was some...
Dude, that was a whole other console ago.
Yeah, and I feel like, for some reason, I feel like I remember, like, World War II footage and, like, Kratos
really?
Is, like, the god of war back... Yeah, yeah. I mean, because David Jaffe talked... The funny thing is, obviously the franchise has had a different director every iteration. And
right.
So for God of War 3, they had every director come back together and talk about how they envisioned how the franchise would end. So... Jaffe, he was like, oh, well, I always thought that, like, for every game, we would just do like different eras of time. Like it wouldn't even stick to the Greek mythology.
Oh wow! Right? So Kratos is the god of war. Like he becomes the god of war, and then like your every war is he's involved in somehow some way.
See, that's an entirely different direction to take it. That would
but be but then cool. Obviously, you know, God of War 2 changed that, yeah, and yeah. Then you know things pivoted, and you know, but I mean, I would love to see something far more ambitious, you know, and take a page from Assassin's Creed, you know. I think you can. I think that franchise proved that you can actually have different main heroes in every main iteration of a franchise.
Well, I mean, and there's
cool
keep fiction opportunities to bring heroes of Greek mythology into different historic eras.
Yeah,
there's some really cool opportunities there.
I do feel like, you know, Sony, you know, they're like, oh well, Kratos is one of our most iconic characters. We have to put him in another game, but. We told his story, I guess, prequel.
Kratos in the trench warfare of World War I, which was all very like hand to hand and melee oriented, and
right.
Like that could be crazy, bizarre.
And I mean, I love the chain blades, but you know, what's the next big thing for the series,
dude? I don't know. The chain blades might be sacred.
They're pretty badass.
I will admit,
like I always go back to them, regardless of what weapons I'm
because
carrying.
The problem I saw when I was thinking about that, going back to mythology thing, is that I think that they are a little bit pigeonholed in that it's hard to have another Kratos stature figure in the hierarchy that they built between gods, titans. And then, oh, that's right, Kratos, the wild card, he screws everything up. And yeah, so he does screw everything up.
You can't even play as Hercules. Actually, gets his ass kicked by Kratos.
Actually, Jeff, now we really remember what Jeff said. It wasn't just different time eras. It was different religions altogether, actually. So, like,
whoa.
God of War 1 is, you know, obviously by Greek mythology, but then, like, actually just go on to different mythologies.
See, now that's
altogether.
Even cooler wow. Because that goes back to, have you ever read or heard of the, like, Elric of Melniboné books? So are these books? There's a series of fantasy books, and the core series that I got hooked on to was Elric of Melniboné. But it turned out that the author was actually, and I think it was Zelazny who was writing these. I can look it up in a minute, like Roger Zelazny, I think. I want to make sure and check that out. But anyway, Elric was this one series, but then I found out there was another series called Hawkmoon, and then I found out the bigger thing was that he was writing these books about the quote-unquote eternal champion, and it was really cool, and what it was the projection of this projection of this eternal champion spirit across different planes of the metaverse, and then in each world he manifested, or the hero manifested themselves in a way that worked within that world. And that's a really cool kind of idea. You could do the same thing with like the God of War, but in different religions and different cultures.
Yeah, somebody needs to do that. That's
that could be
badass. Awesome.
That could be really badass.
I agree.
Well, I just got excited for the next God of War game that doesn't have Kratos.
I'm sure they've been thinking about that some. All right, we will take a little break, see if Mr. Kanata arrives. We still have some... I want to talk a little bit about Gears of War, which I played some... I got judged, did the judgment.
Word.
My judgment is microtransactions. Oh.
I agree with that judgment.
Anyway, we will not charge you any extra for listening to the rest of the show, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Weekend Confirmed.
Sure, you can pay $60 if you want to play a video game. But what if you want to play all the latest video games? Try Gamefly.com, the number one video game rental service. Right now, you can sign up for just $5.95, their lowest price ever. Gamefly has over 8,000 titles, including the hottest new releases like DMC Devil May Cry, The Walking Dead, and Hitman Absolution. And here's how easy it is. Just sign up, select your games, and Gamefly will ship them directly to your door. You can keep the games as long as you want, there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. Once you're done playing a game, send it back, and Gamefly will send you the next available game on your list. Now, you can also play hundreds of PC games with Gamefly's new Unlimited PC Play, which is free for members. Gamefly also saves you money by letting you try your favorite games before buying them. If you really like the game you're playing, simply click Keep It on the Gamefly website, and it's yours at a deeply discounted price. And if you're still unsure... which you shouldn't be at this point. But if you're still unsure, we're offering our listeners a special offer. This is just for Weekend Confirmers. Go to gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed for an extended 15-day free trial. That's GAMEFLY.com/weekendconfirmed and sign up today.
All right, and a wild Kanata appears.
I'm here. I got here. I apologize to everyone.
Is it the shiny variant?
Did you see that video you shared with me? Oh, okay. Andrew shares with me this video the other day of some guy who's been like trying to get a shiny variant of
Ponyta, I think, or something like that.
And literally, this person had a rack of Game Boys, all of them playing different versions. And was like pounding through them and was like keeping track on what looked like a Texas Instruments scientific calculator of how many times he tried battles. It was like, I got it after only 435,000 tries. I'm like, oh my lord, this guy's like really crazy.
And then once he finally encounters the shiny Ponyta, he just flips.
Oh,
well, I hope it was worth it.
Yeah.
Speaking of amazing videos, I hope you guys have already referenced the amazing Nicole Z Explains Gears video.
I was just about to give proper respects to Nick Bristow, who once again has come through strong.
Unbelievably awesome and hilarious.
Yeah, we're taking votes now, and there's been some running commentary over there. So far, the front runners are Halo, which
that's a good one,
right? Yeah. And Resident Evil.
Resident Evil's good. I think Uncharted would be fun.
Uncharted would be another good one, right? Yeah. But Nick, excellent work on the videos.
She's got a backlog now.
And Nicole's great work on the story time. So there you go. You can help us decide what the next story time and story time.
You need to get Nicole on some Suda 51's joint.
Yeah, I think it needs to get a bit crazier than that. Like, I want her to explain the story of F-Zero GX
or Killer, like, Killer 7.
Oh yeah, Killer 7 would be good. Or like the entire Devil May Cry series.
Does that even have a story?
Like, yeah, that would be. Or the Mario franchise. Like if it were all connected somehow,
which I think it should be, by the way. I was thinking about that.
Fans have made a timeline.
I wish the Nintendo universe was like the Marvel universe, where they attempted to stitch everything together in some bizarro zomboid kind of way.
That would be really zomboid kind of way.
Yeah.
Well, we could give her, you know, a couple of weeks with Hyrule Historia and let her try and tackle.
There you go.
Let her try and tackle Zelda with multiple endings. So, you see,
there's only three different universes.
Nicole is just going to slowly take over the entire show until you and I are like, hi, welcome to Nicole's show. And then
at least you get to sing the theme song. I'm just sitting here going, okay, someone bring me another beer, something.
That sounds like the dream job for you.
I was going to say,
it's
a good role.
I also, since I wasn't here at the beginning, I want to say it's awesome to see you, Jeff.
Dude, it's awesome to be back. And it's awesome to finally have you in the studio.
Miss you, buddy.
Yeah.
Totally. All right.
First of many times, I think.
What are we talking about? What are we talking about?
I told you in the break what we've gone through. You missed Cart Life. You missed God of War. And then I played Gears of War, which I think, much like God of War, we were having this discussion of whether it's like back to the well one too many times, but then also how it balances out for people who haven't been to the well so many times that they're ready for another drink. And, you know, in that case, God of War, actually, you know, we're like Jeff said, look, it's got the God of War mechanic to it. It's got the God of War play. If you're into that, you wanted more, then it's actually like right up what you want. And Gears sort of does the same things, although it does a couple of twists that I think are interesting in single player. And then multiplayer to me is sort of multiplayer to me is like really one of those situations of a coin of two sides, one of them being really great and one of them being really frustrating.
One of them being lack of horde mode.
Well, yeah. And just like, look, we're going to talk about it in a minute, but the microtransaction system and how thin multiplayer feels in the box is really weird. I mean, especially for a game that has been so great in multiplayer. But let's talk about single player. Single player in Gears of War Judgment is also prequel, and it goes back, but it uses, they're getting really, I was going to say something catty. I won't say something catty. It is interesting to me that they would try a more sophisticated storytelling methodology than just telling the story. The game starts off with you as Baird being taken to trial, and you're telling the story of the game you're going to play through testimony in court.
I think that's cool.
And it's kind of cool.
I like narrative devices. I think that too few games employ them. I mean, you see narrative devices in all kinds of other media. I think it's cool.
I have to say that right off the bat, my expectations for the game were totally shifted when, like, the game's starting and you're doing the cinematic and you're going to trial and I'm like, what is going on here? And then I realized, tell us a testimony. And then that's the game. And I'm like, wow.
It all started on that fateful day.
I'd like to call my first witness.
Yeah. Yeah. But I really didn't expect that out of a Gears of War game, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's a little bit of a subtlety there. I thought that was really cool. And then the piece that builds on this that is really cool and something that I think that they integrated into the game very well is they have these you come into each level and so here's the trade-off. Each area that you play is small and tight and constricted, and it is really. Remember how in Bulletstorm you would play through levels and you would go for scores and they had like that whole score keeping system where you tried to beat your friends?
Yeah,
it feels like there's still a lot of that DNA here because there's a 3-star system to the game. And one of the easiest ways to build them up is that right when you come into a level, you'll see a big glowing cog symbol on the wall and you walk up to it and examine it. And it'll let you, if you want to, play the declassified version of the mission. And the declassified version of the mission tells you the rest of the story that they didn't get. So, and it's kind of cool. It's kind of woven into the tapestry of the testimony very well because you don't really know. So one thing, you don't know what Baird's on trial for. And he's just giving this testimony. And as you start into each section, then when you get to these classified sections, it'll say, oh, but such and such was rumored to have happened or was said to have happened. And if you're able to satisfy those parameters, then you can, in essence, in my mind, I mean, I don't know if it's how to work out, but it's almost like you're proving that those things happened. So for instance,
So they're sort of locked behind achievements inside the level.
Well, it makes the level harder to do. You don't have to do them. So,
right. But it's sort of like if you're better at doing the level, you get to see more of it or a different view of it.
I don't know if you get to see more of it or a different view of it, but by virtue of having done the challenge, you have mastered the level and maybe changed
made
the narrative
his case
out.
Better.
Maybe he's made his case better.
That's a cool idea.
I think if that does indeed, I mean, look, I only played the game for several hours last night, and I also wanted to play multiplayer, so I hopped in and played a couple hours of multiplayer as well. So, you know, keep in mind, I've only played like the first 2 hours, 20 minutes, 2 hours, 30 minutes of single player. But like, for example, very early on, so, this, you know, I don't really think it's a spoiler because this is very, very early on. It's like the third level or so. There's a timed level. I'm sorry, there's not a timed. There's a level that if you want to unclassify it, then you have to do it within a time constraint.
And the
time constraint is dictated.
They're effectively like hard mode.
It's effectively like hard mode.
Yeah.
And the time constraint is that you come into this area, and if you don't choose to do the declassified, then the next thing that I'm about to tell you doesn't happen. But if you do choose it, then Baird says, reveals that, oh, they've made this a Hammer of Dawn free fire zone. Our radios aren't working, so we don't have any way to tell base not to fire, and they're going to fire the Hammer of Dawn again in 4 minutes. And so you've got 4 minutes to get through this little gauntlet and get to the exit of that level or be fried.
Hmm.
Now, they're not all binary. They're not all
dire. Is
there
a point where Phoenix Wright stands up and goes, "Objection!"
No.
No.
Baird's on trial for using up all the peroxide and, in the world.
He's not a true blonde.
You know, Ozzy did our review, and he didn't really like Baird, but Baird's okay. He's not a bad character. I mean, I think it's just that, like, Cole and Dom and all those guys, like, Cole's in the game, but, you know, like...
They soak up all the personality. Those guys just ooze personality.
That's what I'm going to say, is, like, they were just... They were big, like they were like larger
slightly,
than life characters
different.
Anyway.
Yeah. They are certainly larger than life. Yes.
Different flavor of Musclehead.
Yeah.
So the trade-off is then that each of the segments of the single player games that you play in the single player game so far have been really brief experiences, relatively brief. It's like get in. Here's the deal. Boom, bang, and then at the end of them. You literally get to a point where you see a prompt on screen that says continue, and you press continue, and it's like a little mid-match recap rest zone. It's really strange.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
So you start off, and you do your little mission level, like whatever it might be.
Yeah, I got that.
And then you
much.
Get to the end, you press continue,
right.
And then there'll be the little cinematic that takes you to the next level, but while you're in that, it's like you're invulnerable, and it recaps everything. It's like, does the quick recap. It says, you killed this many people, you got this many headshots, you got this many gibs, you got this many crushers, and you played
it. So it's like a score recap.
Yeah, you got like a score recap. It's very.
I have a question.
It's a very weird staccato progression to single player.
It's like the Grand Theft Auto... you know, expansion packs where you'd finish. I think it was just Gaytony, actually, Ballad of Gaytony, where you'd basically like finish a mission and it would give you a banner across the screen that would be like, oh, these are the objectives you completed. You damaged your car, so you didn't check this one off.
Similar, yeah, it's the same sort of thing like that. Yeah, it makes the single player really broken up. So here they have
it's like how FPSs used to be in the day, like Doom and
Metal Gear Rising. You know, when every checkpoint it's like, oh, you got an S rank.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
But the question I have is. given the way the story is framed, if you die, does the like game like does you know Bear be like, oh wait, no, I didn't die? Like, does he say that? Yeah.
No, wait, that's not what happened.
So I'm innocent, guys. Yeah. I'm innocent and also dead.
Yeah, that's clearly not what happened. Yeah. No, it doesn't do that.
The missed opportunity, really.
They added a rewind mechanic a la Prince of Persia. You know, this isn't exactly how it happened.
Oh, no.
I didn't die.
It could have happened like this.
To talk to the similarity of... Oh, I didn't get the Clue reference, but
it wasn't very well executed.
I love that movie.
Me too.
To go back to the same thing that Jeff was talking about is that it still feels... like the one thing People Can Fly have clearly demonstrated here is that they absolutely are on par chops-wise to make a Gears game. It is Gears of War. I mean, maybe the levels are not as large or as expansive, but what they're doing in them is different, so the game sort of dictated that. But the moment-to-moment gunplay with a Lancer in your hand, revving up the chainsaw, taking on the Locusts is every bit Gears of War.
But are those additional unlocks? I guess unlock is probably the wrong word. Those sort of hard mode-esque additional challenges, are those more creative like Bulletstorm was, or are
no.
they
no it's they're just, not as creative as Bulletstorm
it's not I mean, like,
but they are
I mean
they are kind of cool
they,
so here's another thing that they've done that's cool is that the mission types have a good bit of variety to them. I mean they threw at you the occasional escort mission. There's like the time
oh,
thing
that
was just
you say that like it's a good thing.
But it, like occasional is yeah. To give you a little something different, that's okay. They give you different combat scenarios and, of course, getting across something in a timed sort of deal. But they yeah. also throw defense horde mode-like single-player levels at you mm-hmm. where you need to hold this position for the next 3 minutes. And they give you a couple of turrets and you've got the guys with you to try and hold on. But that's that does cool. sort of highlight one of the problems is that the AI. So you can also play this game 4-player co-op in the campaign.
Cool.
Which is awesome. And you might want to do that because your AI buddies are not.
Does he have new friends that aren't our cast of characters?
Well, so the only one you can recognize is Cole.
And oh, then, woo! On a Cole train. I want him to get his own game. It's a train simulator.
Yeah, of course.
I would love Cole.
Are you sure? Are you sure it's not like a disco dance party? Could yeah. be like Coltrane.
That would be cool.
Like,
the Coltrane dancers.
He's like Don Cornelius.
That'd be cool. It's a rhythm game.
Gosh. Anyways, the AI is really bad. The AI is pretty
really?
Bad. Yeah, the AI is pretty
worse
bad.
Worse than previous Gears games?
Ariel and I have been playing the previous Gears games together, so I guess I don't have a good bellwether for that, but they're not the brightest. And the enemies are not that great. There seems to be some disconnects in the enemy AIs, where at times they will find themselves in positions that for some reason their AI routine can't reason out what to do next, and they just sort of stop.
Oh.
And get, like, they'll just be stopped. You'll find them, like, behind a wall in
maybe they're hiding. Wow, that's not good.
But, like, yeah, but, like, really just hiding. Just, like, stop. They're just, like, hiding, not moving, not doing anything, waiting for you to come by and just munch them.
Well, clearly they're AFK. I mean...
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, now I understand. Right. They didn't have time to this is the first generation of really connected games, and you see what happened was People Could Fly couldn't do all the AI. So what they did was they hired a bunch of Chinese kids to sit inside these sweatshops.
You realize that what you're doing is just spawn camping. And that's
super
true. Lame.
So somewhere there is a giant factory of kids sitting around computers playing all the AI characters for
It's cheaper than writing AI code.
This is the future.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, kid, I got a job for you. Oh, what is it going to be? Ah, you're going to play games all day.
But all you do is run out of this door and die.
Yeah.
This is a terrible story.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, so then multiplayer, I hopped on last night. And, of course, the big news was that Horde was gone. And so I immediately went, I'm going to go play Survival. And Survival is their new, like, Horde replacement, and the idea is that you play with your co-op partners, and you're trying to defend a series. So you're trying to survive 10 waves of attacks, and during each wave of attacks, you're trying to fend off the Locusts from hitting a emergence hole. And the fiction part of it is that there's these giant cap plates that they put over the emergence holes, and the locusts can come and then beat them up, and the emergent, and once they open up the emergence hole, more locusts can come out, and so you can get driven back. There's two plates, and then finally at the end of that there's this generator, and the generator is supplying the power, and if the generator gets knocked out, then your team loses. And you know, over that path of through the level, you have to hold off 10 waves. And there's four character classes that you can start as. There is a medic class, an engineer class, a soldier class, and medic, engineer, soldier, and scout.
Oh, and this, just the characters that you fight with in single player. You, I mean, obviously you said their AI is not so great, but what is it? Just like faceless, like the character in Gears of War. I guess it was two, or it was like the dude who had the mask on all the time. He's like,
it's not you, it's not Baird, it's you, red shirt.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's you and Cole, and I think the dude's name is Petraeus or something like that, and he seems to be...
General David Petraeus?
That's probably why I have Petraeus in mind. I hope that... Well, you can look it up, but anyway... Paddock, okay. So, anyway, he's definitely patterned off of sort of like an Eastern European stereotype. Okay. I mean, you know, not totally big and burly, but he sort of has that same sort of dialect and approach, and he's... I mean, he's a pretty tough guy.
Does
and then
he have charming accent? No.
Yes, but not quite that bad. But okay. Yeah, that's all right.
I don't even know what that's like. Just, you know, Eastern European.
Generic. And then there's the like fresh out of the academy rookie chick who's your medic.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Mm. How does medic class work? Is it shoot health into someone, or is
It's health gas grenades.
Okay.
You like drop a grenade. So everything in this is, so this is a mechanism that they use throughout the multiplayer is all radius based power ups. So the soldier drops an ammo box, and there's a radius that it shows that you come stand within and you load up on ammo. Mm. And the medic drops a gas grenade thing, and there's a radius you come stand within and it heals you up.
It's critical to go to med school for that stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know,
like all this that smells like healthy. Off.
Yeah, exactly.
Weird looking gas. And then the scout has a beacon that they drop, and it's sort of a radar thing that exposes enemies when they're, you know, locusts when they're attacking. And the engineer, of course, is different. Engineer can drop a turret, and the engineer also has the repair gun. So I found that it was really fun to play, but it was not as satisfying as Horde, and I'm not exactly sure. The whole fallback mechanic is really frustrating, especially, you know, depending on how well you're able to work with the teammates that you're working with, number one. And number two, it's only 10 levels. I mean, it's only 10 waves. And if you remember, like, people playing Horde mode, like, they would go to, it went to 50?
It was some, I never got
it. Was a ridiculous number, but, like, there was, like, a real pride thing, but it, like, gave it a much more gentle curve. This thing, because it's only 10 waves, by wave 6 or 7, things are getting pretty hairy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're getting very hairy. As a matter of fact, I was playing last night and went through, I'd say, probably 7 or 8 matches and never got further than wave 9. Hmm. Got to wave 7 a bunch of times.
But that's how, if it only has 10 waves, that should be how it is.
That's probably how it should be.
Yeah.
But here's the other problem. There's only 4 maps. And this is the thing I wanted to get to about multiplayer. There's only 4 maps for each of the two types. There's only 4 maps for the two variants that are... So along...
Wait 6 weeks.
Hmm. And then you can buy more.
Yeah.
15 bucks.
So there's a lot of purchase stuff in this.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of character customization. So you can now, when you're playing multiplayer for Deathmatch, you can create a custom character. And there's some things that you can open through in the game, but there's also a bunch of stuff that you can unlock through Microsoft points.
Yeah.
For about $3 a skin.
Or not. If you're,
like, yeah, I mean, it's a little pricey.
Hmm. Is it cool looking stuff, at least? How many shoulder pads do I get?
Okay, show me a weapon skin you'd buy for $3.
Yeah, I mean, dude, like
there's, I wouldn't buy any, right. But I also bought a Puma for my Terra character. So,
yeah,
what are you gonna do?
That's true.
I can't throw stones. I live in a glass house made of microtransaction glass.
You know, we were all horse armors making a triumphant return. You know,
yeah.
So anyway, so they have survival, and then the other mode, which the name just flitted out of my head. Is the same thing, but instead of facing AIs, it's real people on both sides. And that mode is the coolest. That's it's not Conquest. Damn it, I wish I could remember the name of it. I have to look at it. I should write myself more notes out here, right?
You should.
I should do that. Overrun. So Overrun is the other side, and it's really cool. It actually is like, wow, I wish they had gotten to this sooner. It makes a lot of sense because you've got like the whole dynamic. And what happens in Overrun is that each team takes two turns playing the other side. So you get to play the Cogs, and then you get to play the Locust, and then you get to play the Cogs again, and then you get to play the Locusts again. And it's the same thing as, you know, when they had combat before. When you hop in on the Locust side, you have like the baseline rank and file guys at first, and then you earn points and you can level up, and then you can go be a Scorpion guy or or a Corpser. But that stuff is really fun.
Yeah.
That stuff is really fun.
I dug that mode in 3.
And Deathmatch is Deathmatch, and you know,
It's Gearsy.
But again, 4 maps. Like it literally last night, in the amount of time that I played, I was already like, okay, I know this map. Okay, I know this map. And I mean, I guess that's
a good thing, yeah.
It's sort of a good thing at the same time. I don't know, like,
yeah.
4 maps for 2 different kinds of modes, is that satisfying?
Not if you're a multiplayer gamer. I mean, you know, not if that's one of the core reasons you're buying it. I mean, I know a lot of people that would buy it and play through the single player campaign and, you know, get rid of it or whatever, or let it sit on the shelf. And, you know, then the other half of the crew is like, okay, I'm a multiplayer, so I don't even touch the single player. Like, I'm just going in there and, oh, wait, no horde mode. And, oh, wait, what's, I don't know.
I'm just saying, like, for a $60 game, and multiplayer is really important, to only have 4 levels for your multiplayer modes, and then to also have already indications that you're thinking about, you know, expensive, microtransactions. Or what was as the Shaq commenter on the review put, that's not really a microtransaction at that point, is it?
It's a transaction.
I mean, like, it's a fair bit of chunk of change for, you know, skins.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gears. It is Gears. It's definitely Gears. I mean, I think that the big takeaway I have from this is that everything we thought about People Can Fly from Bulletstorm is absolutely accurate. Like, they're really cool shop. They're a really good shop with loads and loads of potential. Definitely did a great job on this game. Definitely brought some interesting ideas to it.
I wish they'd been able to make a Bulletstorm too.
Man,
that game could have been.
Well,
awesome.
What do you mean wished? Maybe they will now.
I hope so. That'd be awesome.
I mean, a Bulletstorm 2, thinking about that on next gen consoles.
Yes.
Would be awesome.
Bring it.
And it's an IP that hasn't been totally, you know, sullied.
Well, it didn't do well, if I remember.
Well, no, because when it came out, I think it was amidst a couple of other shooters that were higher profile and like, but it was solid. It was good. I mean, I went back and played it.
I really dug it.
And yeah. I
mean, and it was colorful.
Yeah.
And it was
and different.
Playful and different and just and got a little bit too hung up on dick tits.
This sense of humor was in the toilet. And also, my mom is in the other room. So thanks, Garnet, for that phrase. No, I'm just kidding. She is, though.
she totally is. I'm just saying that right there explains where their marketing went awry.
Yeah.
Is that it's sort of like, but at that point, you've degenerated to a silly
state. It was actually funny. It was funny because it was so in on its own joke. It knew that it was not. It was making fun of itself and making fun of the genre. And I'm the first one to criticize something for being unnecessarily crass. And it was fun. It was genuinely funny. Yeah. So,
I mean, it was self-aware. Like, it wasn't crass and mean. It was crass and funny.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, it was so irreverent.
If you like Gears, I don't have a problem telling you that it's a fun game as long as you're cool with the single-player levels being more staccato and small and the multiplayer at the moment being in chunks of 4 levels and expecting microtransactions. But, you know, look, the day of the $60 game with transactions has arrived. I mean, this is it. Then next generation, it's going to become the standard. You will buy games and there will be loads and loads of microtransactions. It won't just be DLC levels. It's going to be lots of stuff inside the games.
Yeah.
So just the way it is.
That's the way it is.
I'm not thrilled about it. We can discuss that another time, but that's the way it is. And you said you bought, what did you buy in Terra?
A mount.
Why do you sound so sheepish about it?
Because it was $10,000.
That's where the Kickstarter money went.
Spent all the Kickstarter money already?
No.
On a mount.
How much did the mount cost? I'm just curious. Do you mind?
Yeah, I think it was $4?
Okay.
Something like that. $5 maybe?
Yeah. Right. Given the number of hours that you put into that game, though, I think the $4 investment at that point is probably
true.
You know.
I'm not proud of myself.
do you still...
I ride it.
Get enjoyment from riding your
Puma.
Yeah,
but what, I mean, it's actually a lioness, but I call it a puma because it looks kind
of
like a puma.
See, why are you not proud of it? That is the game working. That is free to play working.
It's working me. It's working my wallet.
I mean, are you proud when you smoke another cigarette? That's cigarette.
Wait,
working.
Hold on a second. How much Terra did you play? I mean, admittedly, you bought the game originally.
So I'll be honest. I got a press copy.
But had it been free to play Yes. And you had played the game as much as you have, and right. had bought this mount for $5. That's a ridiculously good value.
True.
Right?
True.
And yeah. That is the economies of scale.
And that's what they want. They want you to be paying for things that you actually want rather than just paying for the privilege of playing it.
Well, and I think the good news for you is that as a fan of Terra is that it's been a wildly successful since going free-to-play.
Yeah, it has. So, what do they quadruple their...
They have gone... So since going free-to-play, Terra has completely blown up. It is now over 1.4 million users, so it's probably closing in on 1.5 million users. But bigger than that, their concurrent players has gone up over 10 times. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And they're not worrying about it. They're not upset that, like, oh, we have to support all these people that are free. They're bragging about it. In fact, they're so excited they're actually doing a special event coming up. I know you're going to want to get in on this. Have you checked it out?
No, I haven't checked it out.
It's called Dracoloth's Rising.
Oh, yeah. The Dracoloths are infesting the land, and they need to be destroyed.
Well, you're going to be into this because it's going to be a whole event to hunt big-ass monsters.
Yes.
Bams. And get special drops and prizes.
And also,
I think they've done that before already.
Dragons are a cross between, Dracoloths are a cross between dragons and sloths, just so
you don't. Oh, I thought they were a cross between dragons and, like, tidy wipes, cloths.
Oh, yeah, maybe that's the other version. Sorry.
Dracosloths.
Dracosloth. It's a slower, more boring dragon.
Right.
Just with no wings.
Clings to trees.
Yeah. Just kind of sits there.
And just chews on leaves.
But it's a dragon, dude.
And it's infesting the land of Terra.
Yes. So you need to be wiping those bad boys out.
And there you
have it. You know, it's been a really too long since I got logged on Terra.
And so the cool part of this is, like, that's a big statement of how big free-to-play works, right?
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's great.
If it had hit sooner for Star Wars The Old Republic, who knows who might still have their job? Because we also learned this week that Star Wars The Old Republic is, what was the number, Andrew?
They went up by 2 million players since going free-to-play. And that was, what, 5 months ago? So that's a lot.
Yeah.
And what was it? You had, like, a quote from their executive producer. He's like... He apologized for slow to switch or something.
Something like that, where it's like, you know, we weren't focused on the right problems.
We didn't realize you guys didn't want to pay for this.
Our bad.
We had no idea how many people wanted this without paying for it. This is a huge hit for no money.
Well.
I mean, it is weird that it's like, how many people were like, you should just be free to play? Like, just from day one, you know, before day one, day negative 1 million. I don't know.
Well, I think that.
thanks for zeroing in on that.
Very, very, very eloquent.
Way to clear that up.
I'm a journalist here.
Oh, man.
All facts.
Oh, guys, so let's make a game in a million days from now. But right now, let's decide that it's free to play.
The Old Republic was pretty snake bit, actually, if you look at it in terms of its development, which took forever. We were talking about a 5-year development span. So massive amount of time in development. And during that time, it happened to be, if there was a game that was in the wrong time place to be caught in that sort of development cycle, it was The Old Republic, because there certainly wasn't much of a hint of where free to play was going to go when they started down that aisle. And by the time they were ready, the handwriting was all over. I mean, it wasn't just the handwriting on the wall. The whole world had changed.
Yeah.
The whole world had changed, but they were so committed to it that they couldn't really, I guess they felt they couldn't change the formula.
Well, and then they had to jury rig free to play into the game, you know, which is a whole entire effort in and of itself.
It did sort of become a mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, they thought they had the next WoW on their hands when they...
They did.
You know.
And I think rightfully so. They thought, hey, we're going to do... Yeah. They were looking around there when they were first starting and even midway into development, saying, look how well WoW is doing. And we have Star Wars. And we have people writing amazing fiction and campaigns. People are going to love this. They're going to hop in. They're going to pay their fee. They're going to be here month in and month out. And we're going to make a great, thriving game. And then that didn't happen because the world had changed. And I wonder how many... I would love to know how many, because WoW has been shedding players, I wonder how many remaining players even are still really active. You know, I wonder
probably
how many.
Probably a lot.
You think?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they just had a new expansion that that didn't do poorly.
Pandaria, right?
Yeah. So I think that's still a community that...
WoW is the only MMO where I actually know, have friends who will convene still with their family members and their mom and dad and, like, people that don't normally play, you know, on MMOs, and they will actually get together and socialize. And part of that's because it's been going on for so long, partly because it's, you know, actually really easy to get in and start playing. But yeah, I mean, it's – I think those are the people that are still playing. Is like you max out a few characters. You're in there because of the social aspect. You're in there because you love it, not because you want to level up another.
It's the Disney of MMOs.
Well, and it also is indicative of a sort of shift that's happened in the way people consume games, is that, like, you know, most of us, and I probably include a lot of you out there who are listening right now, are think of ourselves as gamers, and we play a lot of different games, right? Mm-hmm. We might play Metal Gear today and StarCraft tomorrow and something on our iPhone on Saturday. But there's a whole other world of gamers that's arisen over the last, you know, especially last couple of years, where there's the...
That deep dive, that's commitment to one franchise.
And they're not, they don't think of themselves as a gamer, they just have their thing. It's almost like a sports...
I play Call of Duty, and exactly. I play it every night for 6 months.
I play Dota, I play League of Legends, I play StarCraft 2, I play... And they're all very competitive games. It seems like there's a definite sort of...
They're social, and they reward skill, and they reward, they have depth that you can achieve by repetition. So that, you really are rewarded for investing that kind of time and devotion.
It's interesting. It's just, it's developed an entire separate sort of world around the way we think of who are people playing games and what sort of people play games, right?
Yeah.
So then wrapping up on this whole thread that we're on, we lost John Riccitiello from Electronic Arts. He stepped down from the CEO position there. In his resignation letter, he said that this is a tough decision, but it all comes down to accountability. The progress EA has made on transitioning to digital games and services is something I'm extremely proud of. However, it certainly looks like we will come in at the low end of or slightly below the financial guidance we issued in January. And we've fallen short of the internal operating plan we set 1 year ago. EA's shareholders and employees expect better, and I am accountable for the miss. So the only thing I have to say about this is that I thought that the internet's reaction that was very strongly, or at least the vocal internet reaction to, well, good thing he's gone, is indicative of how hard it is for anyone to see, like, what people do and how they do and what's actually going on. Riccitiello is going down because the stock... I mean, look, it says right there, because the stock price is off. And in large part because of the Old Republic, which was a huge drain on them financially and did not perform the way they expected it to. And he did a lot of good things. Like, the stuff that he's talking about there, like, EA is a company that has come through a very tough time in the video game market and is weathering the storm, whether you think they're doing a great job or not. I mean, the thing is that who knows what it would be like if someone else had been running it. You've gotten a few glimpses of things. The shareholders were never going to endorse any CEO saying, we're not going to do another version of Madden this year. I mean, we're not going to do more Battlefields, which are really successful. I mean, of course, they're going to do those games. And the question is, how do they do other games within that? And we got Dead Space. Pretty cool. I wish that he had been able to push through the Mirror's Edge sequel, which we know we've heard, you know, rumors back and forth about a million times. I really wish that they had gotten to do that. And I think that if anything... You know, I think that he was very, this is conjecture, but I think he was probably very focused on the move that they've made into social and mobile, which they have made. And EA is a social and mobile game company first, really, now, and then a box product game maybe second, I mean, or at least 1B.
I mean, EA has done a really good job of diversifying. And, you know, anyone that creates a portfolio, you know, you want to diversify because, hey, you know, if the mobile, you know, catches fire and you're there, you know, you can take advantage of it. If consoles crash, you know, at least you have a buffer. Yeah. And I think, you know, he did a really great job of really setting up EA. But, you know, you have the company made so many bad mistakes over his tenure. And,
yes, they have.
And, you know, so for like every positive, you know, it sort of conflicts with another negative, you know.
And he was the CEO. And at the end of the day...
And you know, as much as we praised Bulletstorm, you know, that was an EA game as well. So, you know, I know it's EA Partners, but still.
It was.
EA enabled...
The whole Partners program was under his purview, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah. EA enabled a lot of really interesting, risky games this generation that I don't think, you know, other big publishers would do. And, you know, and let's not forget that THQ died this generation, you know, and obviously EA is bigger, but that, you know, that certainly could have happened to any other company. So
we will see who fills that position and how well they are able to take over. It's continually tumultuous time there, and what the next.
I already nominated you, Garnett.
I actually was thinking, like, I wonder what it would be like to go back and get an MBA and try to do a job like that. I don't think I want to do that job, but it would be a fascinating challenge. It would be a fascinating challenge to try and set the corporate tone and guidance for a company like that.
It's funny, though. I think whoever they do bring in is going to have a pretty – going to be in a relatively good position to move the company forward because, you know, although things are down and things aren't – you know, performing as they expected, they're certainly not in dire straits.
Yeah, but they've got a lot of work to do.
They do. But I think, yeah, I mean,
they've got to get the confidence of gamers back with them, and that's gonna be a long road for them to hoe.
Agreed. I just think it's a battle that, you know, it's whoever comes in's battle to lose. Basically, you know, it's hard work, but I think that they've got the capability of doing it. They just need to reevaluate what they're doing.
All right, well, let's save our strength and continue this battle on the other side of this break. We'll be right back for the second half of Weekend Confirmed. This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get up-to-the-minute gaming news along with thousands of HD videos and screenshots. Get into the action by creating your own profile, post updates about what you're playing, and stay connected with friends and other gamers. Tired of standing in lines? Find great deals on new and used games. Pre-order upcoming titles and get Gamefly's daily deals all from the palm of your hand. If you're already a Gamefly member, manage your game queue on the go and keep games you like with just one tap. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. All right, we will get into the second half of the show and stir the pot some by going back to Tomb Raider, which got a lot of people excited last weekend. My goodness. Not the least of which was Jeff Cannata and I, who had our, you know, old married couple argument. So, Jeff, the champions on your side were very vocal in hoping to shout me down. And I have to say that, like, that was a little frustrating because I felt like we had a good exchange.
I agree. I had fun.
Okay.
And there was no animosity.
There wasn't any animosity on my side either. I think that
I shouldn't have used the T word because people just picked that up and ran with it. And I didn't even really mean that. I was tongue in cheek.
The T word.
Troll.
Yeah, I mean, and so here's the thing is that, and we see this across a lot of conversations about games and even across movies and books and whatever. It's like, if you don't agree with my point of view, you must not be hearing me properly. And we hear each other properly. So I'm going to let you guys then, who wrote some comments, talk some about the argument. And then Jeff wants to talk about it some because Jeff reviewed the game for us.
Mattis,
and he's played it as well. So there was an interesting dialogue exchange that went back and forth between a 714 generation and DevSword. Just real quickly, 714 generation pointed out two examples that they felt really illustrated the transition in Lara. And the first one was the example of when she's does her first pistol kill. And remarks that, oh God, you know, and she's got the blood all over her, and she like has that like obviously expressive emotional moment of being overwhelmed with the gravity of having shot and killed someone with her pistol. And then the second one was when she makes it through that. These are both very early on in the game. After she makes that for the first section where she's being hunted out in the woods. And her mentor calls her up on the radio and mentions that, you know, she had to kill people, and she has this dialogue with him about how it was scary that it was easy to kill things, and you know, it started and as a 714 generation prince says, I felt it was spot on commentary about the darkness of our humanity and just what we think we'd never do, but that we find we are more than capable of doing when pressed into a fight or flight situation. So those couple of early on story beats were really working for them, making them feel like the beginning of the degeneration of those social boundaries that we have as people and humanity. DevSword countered that actually the second moment was one of the moments that really made him laugh. It says, I mean, on one level, it's about how I guess deep down Lara's a psychopath, which is a little bizarre. But on the other hand, if you consider on a literal level, it's like, does she have some sort of superpower that lets her overpower hundreds of armed men? Like, you can't just have Lara kill 100 dudes and be like, after that 98th dead body, I really gained a level of self-confidence I needed to make it off the island, because that's just a little silly. And 714 responded, you know, sort of taking some of that into consideration, but then added this piece, which is something that perked my ears up. So I don't see this necessarily as a fault of Tomb Raider any more than it is a fault of Uncharted or other action games of the similar genre. As Jeff said, it's a related but separate conversation from the debate over whether or not Lara has a satisfying story arc on some level. See, the only thing that I don't like about that is saying it's okay because everybody else is doing it.
That's not the argument. It's not. It's saying it's okay because it's a trope of gaming.
Well, isn't that because everybody else does it?
Well, okay, maybe that's a semantic difference, but I think it's an important difference in the sense that it's working within an established mechanic that we all are familiar with, but a layering on top of that a storytelling arc that I find to be refreshing.
Okay,
and I, like you and like our discussion last week, long for the day when we can marry those two things together so that the fun mechanic part and the narrative part don't have to have this weird dissonance between them. But we're not quite there yet. And I think creating an action shooter, which is what, you know, this Tomb Raider is, requires you to shoot stuff. And, you know, that's the game that they're making, unfortunately.
And so
maybe not unfortunate because it's really fun, but
maybe I'm too much of an idealist. But I don't want to just say, oh, well, that's how games are, and that's okay because games are like that and they have to be like that. And so while it applies to Tomb Raider, it applies to, I mean, I had the same complaint with Uncharted.
No, I did too. We had that whole conversation, and I agree with you. We are on the same page about that, but I don't think it goes so far as to distract from the narrative layer the fact that it's only a layer. But that it doesn't permeate down into the mechanics of the game itself, that it's only just a layer on top of the mechanics.
And I guess that's where the two of us diverge, that for me is that it does. I can't in the experience of the game be that clinical and separate the two.
What I'm saying is that it does a better job than Uncharted did of transitioning between those moments.
I mean, I've only played the first, 2 hours of the game, so I don't know how Lara transforms into, you know, the apparently psychopathic murderer that she becomes later on. But the thing is, the tone is very different in Uncharted and in Tomb Raider.
True.
In Uncharted, Nathan never says, oh God, I just killed someone. He actually never has that, like, really introspective moment, because the narrative is never really about that. It's not about his transformation.
Right.
Which is why it feels a lot more jarring in Tomb Raider that, okay, so you are going to address, you know, the fact that, you know, she's becoming a killer and what does that mean? But then you're using the superficial gameplay of a traditional third-person shooter. And that's why there's that disconnect for some people, I think, because it's like, oh, well, you know, now it's just devolving into a third-person shooter. I think Far Cry 3 is actually a really interesting, like, exploration of very subtly about, like, how, yeah, there are these gaming tropes, and Far Cry 3 sort of, you know, skews it in a way where it's like, yeah, of course I'm going to do this. Is fun. This is so much fun. And then at the very end, you're like, wait a second.
Right.
You know?
That's what I want to hear from you, Matt. Whereas you're a big fan of Far Cry 3.
I'm a huge fan of Far Cry 3. And I think that the problem that I have with Tomb Raider's narrative. Now let me preface all this before, you know, everybody overreacts. I like the game for what it does. Like, I think it's a fun shooter experience. I think it's it's fun environments to explore and a little puzzle here and there.
So you hate it?
Well, no. narratively, so this is the note that I wrote down. The seriousness of the tone derails, or creates more of that dissonance between the action and what her character is going through.
Because I find that to be the opposite.
In Uncharted, you've got, it's very obviously an Indiana Jones type trope, right? A character who is the action hero who will, you know, shoot 20 guys and then crack wise to his sidekick and then, you know, slide down a mountain or whatever. And it's all sort of this, like, you know, the old, goes back to the old serials that Indiana Jones is based on, the old movie serials. This game tries to be really serious. I think Far Cry also takes that sort of exaggerated tone or exaggerated stance on that sort of storyline about, hey, you're stranded here, bad shit's happening, you have to rescue your friends. The difference in, like, I mean, I played through Tomb Raider in the span of, like, I don't know, 3 days or whatever. And by the end, I was like, God damn it, I went off this island. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm, it's dark, it's fucking, like, there's nobody smiled, like, it's, there's no, there are no moments of levity to break up this sort of, you know, what is ostensibly a, you know, move from kill section to kill section with the occasional optional puzzle that you could do. And for some reason that I didn't hate it, but it just, it gave me this sort of like, oh, this isn't really gelling for me. I appreciate what they're trying to do with Lara's character. I appreciate what they're trying to do with her. You know, it's sort of this, the dissonance also, you know, goes to that whole, yeah, we're trying to make her more real and we're not trying to sexualize her. And yet, you know, there she is running around in her tank top for the whole game. And yes, it's more a more realistic take on that, but it's still, you know, it's still an evolution of that same sort of thing where it's like there's titillation mixed with, I don't think that it's nearly as responsible about its action and its themes and its narrative as the gameplay itself.
But the central
pretends.
Theme of the game, right up to the last credit moment, is surviving.
Right.
And I think it delivers the idea of someone who's put in an extreme situation for which he is totally unprepared.
Right.
And puts me in that experience and makes me have to do things that are extreme and that perhaps I don't agree with, but or that are exciting, that are thrilling, that get my adrenaline pumping, that are over the top, that are thrilling, that are unrealistic even, but put me in that situation where I feel like I did all of this to survive. Whereas with Uncharted, I think that the dissonance is greater because A, the narratives ask you to care when a central character dies, especially in spoiler,
well,
but
Drake's just off screwing around on an adventure hunt, whereas Lara's supposed to be trying to save her skin and her friend's skin.
Exactly. The stakes are much higher, and I feel like when Drake's like, hey, I want that gold bar over there, I guess I better slaughter 48 dudes,
right.
The dissonance is way more extreme. For me, it's more jarring to be like, why did he have to murder those people
right.
in order to have to get that slip of paper?
Because the motivation isn't as realistic, right? Because in Tomb Raider, it's like, oh, well, Lara has to kill 50 people because otherwise she'll die, right?
Don't get me wrong. In both situations, the fact that you're playing a game that needs to feed you enemies every 30 seconds in order to keep up that action beat breaks any kind of verisimilitude that they could possibly aim for, whether that's...
And that's honestly, like, I don't have a problem with... I like Uncharted. I like the gameplay of... Or the gameplay loop of Tomb Raider where you're, you know, sneaking around and then all of a sudden you're in a firefight and then you're trying to solve a puzzle and you're back to shooting dudes. I like that. That's fine. What I don't particularly like... And maybe it reflects in the one-dimensionalness of the villains in the game and even the main bad guy of the whole game, right? He's basically like Molaram from... Temple of Doom, right?
Yeah.
He is this mystical dude who has some knowledge and he's trying to, you know, bring these supernatural forces to bear. But beyond that, it's like, who the fuck is this guy? Like there is no...
What kind of doesn't matter?
These aren't... Well, it does if you're talking about character development and her actually, you know, facing adversity that matters in any other way other than just, I killed a bunch of bad guys.
Right.
It's like... And I don't have the perfect solution for this, but when you have to have a tonal shift to accommodate that, you know, sort of ridiculous nature of what you're doing, which is, you know,
I think for me, you know, when I play games like Metal Gear Rising or, you know, Bulletstorm, which are clearly, you know, very actiony, over the top and really embrace it, you know, you probably kill like millions of dudes by the end of like one of those games. Like that skews in the completely opposite direction, and I think, you know, that's why the tone is as silly, and that's why we can sort of just have fun with it. I'm not, you know, I feel like for a game that wants to explore killing in a more serious way. You do have to sort of go the opposite direction. If Uncharted is the middle ground between, you know, zany, just fun shooting and, you know, there's this other thing that I don't think games have really successfully explored yet, you know.
Spec Ops.
But I don't think, I don't,
well, yes, Spec
I don't
Ops think might, that's but the you goal. You still kill, like, hundreds of
well,
people.
Well, and that's, and so that was my complaint about Spec Ops, but I think that comparatively, the journey that my character went on in Spec Ops was more smoothly paced across that arc than the one with Lara. And I guess my thing, so my thought about Lara is this, is that, I was talking about this with Jeff, I think that I was not able to pull away from the fact that I think the whole of her adventure takes 3 days. So you get there in one evening, and then there's the night with the deer hunt, and then the overnight going into the block house, and then you come out the next day, and there's the...
Get tread lightly here.
There's a bunch of stuff that you do during the day, right? Yeah. Okay. And then you get someplace, and there's like another evening scene, and then there's the end of the game. But there's a lot that goes on in there.
Yeah.
And that seems like not very much time for... And I finished the game, by the way, since last show. And
did you hate that end moment that you thought you might hate?
No.
I thought that was cool.
I kind of thought that was cool, actually. I was cool with that. And I think Runner Matt put my thoughts into good words. He said, having finally played the game, I get where Garner is coming from. This isn't a Tomb Raider game, and that ain't Lara Croft, which is fine and all, but I think that the devs pulled a bit of a bait and switch by leaning so heavily on fondness for the character and then ignoring it. That said, it's an excellent action game. I think there's, especially in the last third of the game, there are some unbelievable environments and incredible experiences, like stuff that's just, there's like, I could do a spoiler cast on this because there is stuff that's really amazing later in the game that I really, really, really enjoyed. And even better than that, I'll tell you how much I enjoy the game. I enjoy the game so much that the day after that I had finished it, I was sitting at home and was almost like paralyzed for a little while on what to play next. Cause I was like, well, what I'd really like to do is I wish I had more Lara Croft. I wish I had more Tomb Raider to play because I really enjoyed the game. At the same time, I don't want
to lose the other kinds of Lara Croft
I don't
games.
Want that. Not only that, like, I guess this is not too much of a spoiler. I don't envision a Lara who has glee, who takes some sort of delight, no matter how much stress and pressure she's been under, in gruesomely murdering people. Like, burying her axe in people's backs, or...
I don't think she ever expressed glee.
She's, like, enjoying it. She's like, I'm coming to get you all! And she's reveling in it.
That is your interpretation of that moment. Let me just say this.
I'm interested. You don't think that's at least bloodthirsty?
I think
it's... Did you unlock all the finishers?
Yeah.
Did you use them?
I did not use all of them, no.
Okay, so I started using them all the time.
I relied on one weapon for almost the entire game.
Oh, really?
I almost never... I used the shotgun toward the end a lot, but...
That game would have been so much better if all they gave you was the bow.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
And then you basically, re-engineer the combat to make it more like bow...
Oh, and could they have given me the upgraded bow earlier? Because the upgraded bow pieces, especially that last one you get, is freaking badass.
So rad.
I wish they had had that earlier.
But let me say this, because especially what Andrew said... I don't think that these guys set out to make a game that gives you a commentary about death, and I think that it's unfair to lay that at the feet of Tomb Raider. I think what they set out to make was a game where you are inside Lara. I can't even say it right. Wrong.
Lara.
Wrong,
right?
Anyway, you're inside her experience more than you have ever been in a Tomb Raider game before, and I think they succeeded spectacularly at that goal. And they wanted to make an exciting, I assume they wanted to make an exciting, thrilling, fun, interesting adventure, but that put you inside her experience, and that's what I love so much. That's what the success of this game is for me, is much like Far Cry, that feeling of, what would I do in this situation? I would scramble, and if I had the means and the chutzpah and the, physical, sure, ability, I would do all of these cool things.
I thought it was chutzpah.
What?
You made a chutzpah.
I love that feeling. I feel like there's less of that dissonance because I understand where she's coming from through the whole game. And while I, in that situation, would not choose to murder many, many people on the, to get off the island, I can understand her situation.
And I'll even qualify this, and that is, I don't think that, you know, that makes it an unfun game, like killing right. all these people and doing. I don't think it's an unfun game the way that it's set up. I wasn't going to say this, but I guess this is you know, the core of my problem with it. And it's not really fair to judge games this way, but I guess when a game has a legacy and like a, you know, stuff that you can look back on and sort of fantasize about the game that you want to come out before it releases. I was, you know, this is something I said to Garnett too. I'm not sure. I don't know that you fully agreed with me, but I think the tomb raiding in Assassin's Creed 2 is, and the parkour in that and stuff was more fun than the Uncharted style. Okay, I can actually look up the side of this mountain and see the, I have to grab this thing, and then I have to grab this thing, and it's like one linear path up the side of the mountain. And yeah, it looks cool. She's like scrambling up the mountain and stuff, but there is no like, oh, cool, I found the right place to jump. It's like, I just know where to go.
It wasn't as telegraphed paint by numbers as Enslaved. Like, there weren't glowy
bits. Or Uncharted, really.
I would say it was Uncharted. I mean, there's a lot to explore and that there's a lot to run around in, but there's not a lot of question of where to go or what to do next. I mean, you can see exactly where to jump to.
On the collectible side, there's much more of that. How the hell do I even get there to get to some of the collectibles?
I didn't have that.
Really?
Did you 100% the game, Garnet?
I 88%ed it.
Really?
Yeah.
You never had a collectible. I never had a collectible that was on your map where you're like, I'm not really sure how to get there.
Well, I did early on, and then later on I figured out, oh, it's waiting for me to figure out, because one of the things it does want you to do is that Metroid thing of like get a weapon, and now you can go back to an area and figure out how to get through stuff. And I quickly figured out, oh, those ones I can't figure out how to get to, it's probably because I need something else. And then I'd get something and I go, oh, I could go back to that campsite. And I did that a few times. I was like, okay, that was fun. I'm not doing that anymore.
Well, I think we've probably talked about this more than it needs to be talked
about. Well, I'm interested to see how you would compare this, because the big recommendation we got across the internet on Twitter and on Shack News and on NeoGAF was Miasmata.
That's why I bought it.
And I have not had a chance to get it. I want you to tell me about it. What is Miasmata?
Making maps, yo.
It's making maps, triangulating your position.
Wait, right. Make it, maybe like, make
did
it.
You play it?
I'm so glad you're on,
because I thought if anybody played it,
I have not. It's been on my list for a while. I have watched a lot of footage of it, and I've done a bit of research, so I'm not completely ignorant as to, but I have not played it.
Indie
game.
PC-based.
Yes.
Available on
Steam. That's where I got it.
Okay.
$15.
Okay.
This tidal wave of people who are like, the game you're talking about was released in November of last year. Oh! Right. I was like, well, crap. If it's the game I was talking about, I'm buying it. And I plunked down my money for it. And I admit that I've only played maybe 3 hours, probably more like two and change in it. So I am not an expert by any means, but I wanted to get a flavor because I was traveling this week. But I wanted to get a flavor of it. And the premise is exactly what we were talking about. You're on an island. You wake up. Survive, dude. The unfortunate part is that the way they add dramatic tension is you also have a disease and you have to find a cure for it.
The miasmata.
Yes. And so...
Well, there's some creature on the island that's trying to kill you too, right?
I haven't seen that.
Okay, well...
Maybe. I'm super early, as I said.
Okay, fair enough.
And I was just wandering around, like, collecting plants and triangulating my position, which is the stuff they give you very early on. And this game is... I totally admire the concept, and it's exactly the concept we were talking about. The execution isn't not exactly what I would make if I was designing this kind of thing, and it clearly obviously doesn't have the resources of a Tomb Raider. Game starts with a block of text. You wake up every time you encounter something, you get a block of text. It's very unintuitive. It's like, here are these systems, you have to employ them. Do it.
Yeah, if you watch people doing the playthroughs, their first playthroughs of this thing, they're like, wait, what am I doing? Like, what's, I got this thing. What is I? Oh, yeah, and it takes a minute to figure out how everything works.
It clearly comes from a very scientific mind. It's a game about science. It's a game about, you know, you find a laboratory, you got to find some stuff and combine some things and figure out, you know, the right combination of
items.
I'm
not sure that I still even understand Is it like a 3D adventure game?
Yeah,
you have
an idea
of an avatar. It's first person.
First person. You're walking around. Everything is, you know, you have to find fresh water to drink. You have to,
far too few interactable objects, in my opinion. But, you know, you push the right mouse button and you look at your watch and hold up a compass.
Okay.
So there's, I mean, you literally have to triangulate your position to find out where you are on the map. So that means spot a landmark in the distance, walk to another location, spot it again, and then on your map, it'll have two lines emanate that are, triangulate where you are. So that's how you find. So it's very precise. And
it's a cartography game.
It is totally a cartography game.
Right. That was a line.
So, I mean, I think it's really cool. I'm going to play more of it.
Make your own surveying sticks.
Get a dowsing rod.
The worry that I have is that it betrays my argument and enforces Nicole's from last week, which is she's like, that's boring. I don't want that. That's boring. Which is my Nicole impression. I think I sounded exactly like her.
You did. Can you tell me about Pokemon?
But I think... I think that kind of experience wrapped in strong narrative, wrapped in interesting... What that needs is an environment that's full of things to interact with.
That needs, like, tons of dudes to shoot, man. That would make that game so much better. We just need to get... Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's admirable that people set out to make that, and I want that kind of game to succeed. It just needs a layer of... welcoming me. The thing that's so awesome about Far Cry and Tomb Raider, among lots of other things, is how you're brought into that experience from an imaginative standpoint. Like, I imagine that I'm here and this is what's going on, and oh shit, now I have to deal with it. And in this game, it's like, you have a disease. You're on an island. You don't remember anything.
Well, there was another suggestion. Did you catch the other suggestion, which was Lost in Blue?
Lost in Blue, yeah.
Which the first three were DS, but there is a Wii game that we could get.
Yeah.
We could get Lost in Blue,
Lost in Blue.
It's a continuation of the old Survival Kid series. I don't know. I'm curious to see what you do with Miasmata. I might look into Lost in Blue. I'm glad that you guys all enjoy the conversation, and I don't know what else to say about that. We're going to come back on the other side. We're going to get into Luigi's Mansion.
Yeah.
Which you've been playing and Andrew's been playing. And Andrew's also seen Metro Last Light and Finishing Moves, so still a lot more as we wrap up Week in Confirm when we come back for the final segment. Can't ever go wrong with the underworld, can you? All right, so back in the GameCube era, this little game came out at launch called Luigi's Mansion, which I was a champion of. I had a ton of fun with Luigi's Mansion.
Can I reveal something?
Yeah. Mm.
One of the very few GameCube games that I never played.
Really?
Whoa. Never played it.
He's played all of the other ones, though.
I know, it was one of the few. I loved the GameCube.
GameCube's probably
one of my
favorite.
Roommate and I at that time had that, and we would just devour every release.
Dude, you could put a little thermos inside of it and carry your lunch to work.
I mean, I did. I actually used to carry that system around with me, like, everywhere. I would go to school with it. I would go to church with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Why did you go to church with it?
To play Smash Brothers.
Because he went to the Church of Mario.
Good church to go to.
Because Pikmin during a sermon is fucking awesome.
So, I have very fond memories of that because I always thought Luigi's Mansion was a lot of fun and was a cool, like for the time, completely unexpected that here would be Luigi in his own adventure, and it's like this really cool going through this mansion, using his flashlight, deciphering different light and dark puzzles and vacuuming
up. It's still that.
That's awesome.
Now it's in 3D.
I don't like 3D.
It's actually really cool for this game, I think.
I think the 3D effects are done really well.
Yeah. It's like you're in a little diorama.
I mean, I think a lot of first-party games, at least on 3DS, they think about how to design for it. So you have a lot of levels where they're... like the staircase.
Oh, man.
You know, that's perfect in 3D, and they have a snow level. Any snow is always the best in 3D.
Because it's like you're inside a snow globe.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it doesn't add to the gameplay. It's not Mario 3D Land, right. But...
So tell me about Luigi's Mansion for 3DS. Is it Luigi's Mansion? How does it work? Do you still have the same mechanics?
It's exactly the same as Luigi's Mansion.
I never played that first one, but I love this game.
So then, Jeff, since you never played it, describe this game to me then. Since someone, I want to hear what it's like from somebody who hasn't played it.
You are Luigi. You're walking around with a flashlight, and eventually you get other things, including a Ghostbusters pack that's basically just a vacuum. And you have to ghost bust some ghosts whilst... solving little mini puzzles in the environment. The wonderful thing about this game, and I assume it was like this in the original GameCube version, is how much of the level is
vacuumable.
Yeah. Yeah. It responds to your interaction. Every little bit of decoration and pieces of furniture and pieces of lint and crap hanging around, all of it can be affected by you in some way. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything, but it lends to this wonderful feeling of investigating a haunted house, which is exactly the promise of the game. And it delivers that spectacularly, I think. And the puzzles are relatively simple, but super fun, and you feel smart when you figure them out.
Although I have gotten stuck at a few points, and I just feel... This game makes me feel so stupid. I've never felt so... angry at a game because I'm like
really never
no this is because like, wow. because once I see the solution I'm like oh I guess that was it. most of the solutions are just me not using the black light in the right place.
Yeah, you
know? And I get so angry about that.
Yeah, there is a point where you just wander around and do the like three or four things you can do and then you'll pretty much figure it out. But where this game really flies for me is the charm and whimsy it uses to usher Luigi through this. Luigi really has his own personality, and he's like...
He really should star in more games.
Yeah, he's like the dopey version of Mario. And the review packet that I got with this was like, please play this game with a headset. And I completely agree. Audio in this game is wonderful. The soundtrack is awesome. It's just like... clarinet, solo, like... And... Luigi is like humming along to his own songs, like dopily walking around, like. Yeah, it's so great. You just fall in love with the little guy, and when he gets a phone call, because he has a DS, which is funny that it's not a 3DS.
Well, because he had a DS in the original game,
right? When his DS rings, he goes, "Hello." When he answers,
and it, actually,
it's so charming.
And the thing is, I sort of wish the game had more voice acting because
it's great.
Because Luigi, like, he has that one moment where he actually says a line that isn't just He actually has like a spoken line at one point, and it's like sort of jarring, but it's like that felt all right.
It's so great.
That felt good.
And he'll like find the way he finds secret passageways and stuff is that all he wants to do is just sit down for a second. Oh, this chair's spinning around. Wah! You know, it's the wonderful like Laurel and Hardy or these classic film dopey guys like are in way over their head, but it's done with such charm and you feel like you're watching a cartoon.
It is brilliantly animated. It is also gorgeous.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It is so pretty, and I really wish they made a Wii U version of it. You know, I sort of wish Nintendo was copying Sony with that like crossplay thing. You know, it would have been great if they had a 3DS version that I could also just play on Wii U. Just same game, just with HD graphics. I would have loved it. It would look nice with HD graphics.
I really like the 3D though. I have to say, I really enjoy it. You're peering into this little diorama world, and you're peering behind things. And there's all these moments where he looks through cracks in the wall, and he sees like the ghosts being bad when they don't think that anyone can see them. And you know, he uses the gyroscope so you can move it around if you want. And it's just a lovely, wonderful, fun world to be a part of. And you're discovering stuff, and there's always like six different things in the room. You need one of them, and there's like, and it does such a great job of rewarding you with, you know, it's not just coins that pop out, it's freaking like dollar bills, yo, and gold bars and stuff is like
flopping out. Luigi is. Makes a lot of money.
He really does.
Yeah, like you, more money, and it's actually sort of annoying because you max out on your upgrades really quickly because he just makes bank.
Paranormal janitors make a killing.
Yeah. And I don't know if you know this, but if you use your flashlight on some of the enemies, they explode into money.
Yeah, yeah.
like just dollars and stuff. They just explode into dollar bills.
You guys are exuberant over this game.
It's a joy to play.
It's a Nintendo game being a Nintendo game.
Yes.
Which is awesome.
And it's you can just tell there's a level of care put into every little moment and every little movement he makes. And
you guys have been smiling this whole time. Yeah.
The animation really sells the game. And I do think it has, it gets repetitive, you know, and obviously, you know, I do think some of the puzzles really pissed me off. The point when I was stuck today, I knew the solution is just apparently the item just disappeared out of the environment. So I had to restart that level. So I guess that happens once in a while,
happens when you put a Western developer on anything.
Exactly. It's just so unpolished and lazy, you know. It's terrific. I think people should play it.
It sounds like anybody who has a 3DS definitely. It's like
if you're a Nintendo fan. I mean, I really like it.
Andrew, you have the XL.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that up. That is my biggest problem with this game is I can only play it for 20 minutes and then I have to sit it down because my hands cramp. I need an XL.
Well,
the regular 3DS is too small for my
hands. XL's going on sale this weekend.
I might have to get one because I literally
not this weekend. This Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
160 at Target.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
To
including the yellow Pikachu edition.
Even the unemployed guy is interested.
Should be great for playing Monster Hunter.
Combining the R trigger with any of the button presses, which this game asks you to do quite frequently, makes my hand explode. It's hard on that
and
small.
Jeff Kanata is not made out of Legos, so it's very hard to put him back together when his hand explodes. It's not like Lego.
I do wish it would rumble. That once again, you know, I think a Wii U version of this game would have been so good, you know, just you lose the 3D effect, but man, I would love having the map on the gamepad and just, you know, getting the rumble and just the graphics. I don't know. It's good.
That is one of the really cool. I'm not going to delve into Monster Hunter this week because I haven't played it for significantly. But that is one of the really cool things about Monster Hunter is the ability to custom configure the gamepad screen for different elements of the UI. It's kind of silly.
Is cool.
I mean, they go all the way out. If you want to, you can put your health bars and your sharpness bar down there, which I don't think you want to do because you want to see that up there. But it's great for taking the map and getting it off the screen and putting it down here in your hand. It's perfect for that.
That's neat.
Really awesome.
I think all games should let you customize the UI.
They should do that. I mean, that should be a design philosophy for Wii U.
Wii U?
You just move whatever you want onto your handheld portion.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Have you tried the multiplayer of Luigi's Mansion?
No. There's multiplayer.
Yeah, I still haven't been able to try it because Ozzy just never brings his 3DS to the office.
Ozzy,
get with it. Bring that 3DS to the office. What's the multi? Do you know what it is?
I think it's co-op Ghostbusting.
Awesome,
but you can cross the streams.
What?
You can't do that.
Tell them about the Twinkie.
That would be bad.
So the other game that Andrew had a chance to check out this week is Metro Last Light, which was one of the big survivors from the THQ fallout, now has a publisher behind it, and from what we've heard has been really close to release already, so they've had a lot of time to polish and get it ready for a final launch.
It was pretty much done when THQ collapsed, but now they just had to sign all the legal paperwork, and you know, the game is pretty. It is obscenely pretty.
Did you see it on PC or on console?
I did see it on PC, so maybe it looks like shit on a console. Who knows, you know? But on PC, it was running on a gaming laptop. And man,
a gaming laptop?
Yeah, you know, one of those Alienware things, you know, where they're 18 pounds, you know? They're not really that portable.
I saw Star Citizen running on a laptop and that thing. Yeah.
It's
the future.
It's one of those dev kit laptops.
The laptop that will destroy any laps that it's placed upon. Yes.
But, it really, playing that, it reminded me that I had this itch that hasn't been scratched in a long time called Half-Life.
Never heard of it.
Why do you bring this up, Andrew?
Did you guys play Black Mesa?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Do that. It is great. It is free. It is on Steam.
It's awesome.
But yeah, I mean.
Really? I just think, I agree with I mean, I was really nodding my head at Andrew saying that, because I think every time Half-Life comes up, it just sort of reminds me of that empty spot that I have that's just dying for the...
So just play Metro Last Light. It does everything that Half-Life does right, and it just does it, but with Russian accents.
I need to go finish Metro 2033. I started playing Metro 2033 last year when I got my new PC, and was like pretty bowled over by that alone, because it did some amazing graphics effects on the, like, I don't know how it was on, again, I don't know how that was on 360 either. I know they were working to improve their console port, but
remember, I it broke in the middle for me.
Oh right, you didn't like it.
Your gas rushed it. I'm telling you.
With your PC, yeah. Why, yeah. By the way, with
no,
your
it wasn't
PC,
my PC. It was,
that's what I'm saying, with your PC, why were you playing that game on 360?
Listen, I've learned, and I'm that's why I played Tomb Raider on PC. I'm like, I'm
sometimes you just gotta slum it, right, Jeff? I'm just kidding.
I've learned.
I'm not a technology elitist, by the way.
I want to play
the best version of something.
But people were talking about Metro, and you remember, like, Metro did the DX11 patch, and they were doing amazing, like, field of vision stuff. And
also, I will say this. When we were doing TRS, it was very important that we could have one copy and pass it around.
Right.
So you can't really do that with PC versions, so we had to, you know.
And you won't be able to next year.
We'll watch for sales, because even now, Metro Last Light on PC is still, like, I don't, you got halfway, but it would be.
Yeah.
But there's so much to play. So
I
understand how hard
Steam
it is to go
like
back.
$5 on, you know.
Yeah.
On
so Last Light looks fantastic.
Looks fantastic. And, I mean, the reason why I bring up Half-Life is that the DNA is very similar. So, you know, it's linear, highly scripted, very story-based, and, you know, this dystopian sci-fi future. So it has a lot of the same elements, but... And like Half-Life, enemy encounters, you know, half of them are against human enemies, half of them are against monsters. And I love fighting against the humans. The AI.
Really?
It is so satisfying, because, like, they really encourage stealth in the game. And when you're spotted, the way they react. I remember one point there was this, like, band of, bandits, about like 10 of them. I was sneaking behind them, like one by one, taking them out. And what, you know, they're like, wait, where did Sergey go? It's like, and then they start like,
do you remember Sergey? He was standing right here.
Exactly. And they really become like super aggressive. Some of them, I think I was most impressed when there are these two guys. They went into like a back to back position with flashlights, and they're like scanning the environment, so that, like,
you're fighting an army of two,
essentially. So yeah, you could not get near them at all unless you distracted them somehow. And so, like, just,
that's cool.
Yeah, and I one time I died, and I'm like, okay, let me try that you know, a different way. And just, you know, even though it's not technically a stealth game, you know, it's not Dishonored, but, like, man, you know, even though the tools that you have aren't very complicated, like, you can still approach the environment in a completely different way. You know, you can interact with every light, you know, either by shooting it out or, you know, flipping the switch.
Talking to it.
Or, you know, whispering to it gently, you know.
Getting Sergey to flip switch.
So for a little background, by the way, if you're unfamiliar with Metro, which, you know, I think probably there are still people who have heard of it are not completely familiar with it. It is a post-apocalyptic world. It's a post-apocalyptic world set in Moscow, where the Metro... refers to the metro stations, literally, that connected the underground subway system. And what survived of humanity, at least in Moscow, were people who evacuated to the metro system's underground stations and sealed themselves off down there. And while they were sealed off down there, of course, horrible things happened above ground. And there are all manner of very much like demonic-like, crazy creatures, plus mutated people, plus the stir craziness that has set in amongst the people who have survived in the different metro stations underground.
And neo-Nazis.
It's
crazy.
It's a pretty crazy, fragmented, splintered environment.
Is Last Light based on a book as well?
It's actually... it is a sequel to 2033,
right.
But it's like a direct sequel from the game, okay. So it's no longer based on the book. The author has, you know, input in it, but... in terms of making like a.
It became its own thing.
2033 was based on a book.
Yeah. That entire franchise is based on the.
Is the book as good as the game? Because I kind of want to read the book.
I have
listeners.
Not read the book.
Is the book good? Is it? I would be interested in that. I think.
I mean, it is like a cult hit in amongst English speakers, I guess, because it is obviously originally not an English book. So.
Man, I want to go on such a. Well, I'll have to say this for a different episode.
Because okay.
I recently read a book that needs to be a game, and it just
what made book?
Me, The Way of Kings by Brandon Sanderson.
Oh, the first book by Sanderson, and like his Storm, like it's gonna be like a 10-book series. Oh my lord, dude!
But it is built. I mean, clearly the guy plays video games. He talks about it. And Mistborn, his first trilogy, or not first trilogy, but one of his first trilogies, is gonna be a video game, gonna be an RPG. But it so clearly is built with MMO video game influences mm-hmm. in it, and my god, it just made reading that book made me realize how bereft we are of original ideas in video games, and how there is so much fertile ground to be mined and people just aren't doing it. And we don't need to see the million and one Tolkien-esque dwarves and elves and I love me some Dragon Age. Make me a game that doesn't have to retread the same fantasy crap and give me some really interesting environments. And my God, this game, this book, it feels like you're reading a video game in a lot of ways, in the best possible way. That kind of sounds like it could be a negative, but it's awesome.
Wait, so like every time you turn the page, there's a microtransaction.
Yeah. There's like a built-in economy system that would work so well for an MMO. There's like raids in the game. There's a whole flora and fauna system, and nothing is that same old Tolkien-esque BS. Not BS. I love Tolkien.
I love it too.
But it's so played out, man. We don't need another RPG set in a world.
So what you're saying is in my imaginary fantasy world, I could actually have something that was imaginary and...
Yes, and original and vibrant and interesting. And
heresy.
A story that...
Heresy.
You know, like look at The Witcher. Look at these yeah. We don't need to make game... This brings
well,
me.
Well, this is like a subset of the conversation you guys had last week about the same problem with shooters, right? Where it's like, you know, what do we do to why does everything sort of get funneled into this? Let's shoot a bunch of dudes in the face and kind of disguise it a little bit differently, you know?
Yeah,
there are plenty of. I sit up nights sometimes thinking of things you could do that would be a great epic first person experience or whatever that did not involve shooting anyone,
right?
This also relates to the other thing that I was thinking about bringing up in my finishing move is that Richard Garriott interview that PC Gamer did, where he sort of went on this little bit of a crazy person tirade, let's be honest, about how great a designer he is and how few great designers there really are, which, you know, remove the bravado and the sort of, you know, general assholery. He's makes some good points, and that there are too few people. I mean, his whole reasoning in that article or in that interview is that people get into game design because they want to make games, but they don't have other trade skills that fit. They're not artists, they're not programmers, so they sort of become designers by default, rather than people with amazing design philosophies developing that, going to school for that, thinking about design. And then funneling that into a video game, and that, you know, and I kind of agree that there needs to be more focus on, hey, I don't want to just make a shooter that has like two or three new ideas, or a RPG that's set in the same old world that does things, you know, a little bit better. Come at it with a completely fresh, exhilarating idea, a design sense, and there's room for that, and there are plenty of ideas out there. I don't know.
And then have, you know, a few $100 million to make it.
It seems so easy.
Of course. Yeah.
So how far away is Metro Last Light?
I think it's coming out in May.
Oh, so it's right here.
Yeah, I mean, the game was pretty much done when THQ imploded. I think a key thing to point out about it is the attention to detail. Just like I wanted to just spend like hours just looking at like all the devices that the people have like jury rigged in that world, because, you know, like how do you survive underground in the Metro? And apparently like just seeing all the like levees and, you know, poles and strings and weights and counterweights and just like all these like really elaborate things that are made out of like everyday things. It's just like really fascinating just to see that run in engine, and just like the crazy things that they put in there. There's like a burlesque show in one of the episodes, and I'm just watching it. It's like I think I could just sit here for like half an hour and it'll just keep on going, but I guess I should just keep on going, you know? Like I should probably go to my next objective or something. It's just it is you really feel like you're part of the world. So
it's very cool.
That's awesome.
Our details here as we wrap up the show are in our finishing moves.
It's the weekend and it's time for finishing moves.
Yeah, finishing moves time. Let's Jeff Mattis is guest of honor. Let's let him start it off.
Oh, wow, guest of honor. Wow. It's so great to be back, you guys. Thanks for having me back. I'm happy to be back anytime you guys want me. My finishing move, actually, I'm going to highlight a couple of iOS titles, one new, one not so new. They're actually both new to iOS, though. Night Sky, which is an excellent game, Niflis made, and the original game was on PC, but it's ostensibly this 2D platformer where you control an orb that you're rolling along and trying to, you know, get past different physics-based puzzles and solve little things. And it's very cool, very atmospheric. The touch controls actually add a lot to the game, so it's probably the best version. If you're going to pick it up, it's worth checking out. The other one is an experimental game that I just started playing the other day called Mellow Dive. It's a buck, and it's basically this really weird psychedelic thing where you're diving into this, like what looks like a psychedelic cave, and there's like mushrooms growing out of the ground. You can tilt to like move around and boost, and you're supposed to collect these minerals that are flying around. Visually incredible. Definitely worth the buck, even though at this point, after spending an hour, I'm still not 100% sure what I'm doing in it. So
that's why it's experimental.
Yeah. No, it's cool though.
Experimental is like the catch-all for, well, we've got some stuff going on here. It's kind of crazy, kind of cool. I don't know. Have another beer.
I mean, there is a scoring mechanic in it, but like, I'm damned if I know how you accrue points. So there you go.
So I'll go next. Hey, March and March Madness. Hope you have, hope if you are a bracket guy that you're having fun out there.
Upsets already today.
Yes.
Did you see?
Which one are you talking about?
Memphis, didn't they?
Memphis, well, that was at 8-9.
But there was some other, I think there was another, who?
Memphis won.
Memphis won?
There was also huge comebacks.
Oh, was that?
It was a huge comeback.
I was on the plane side and I was only seeing updates on my phone.
Marquette used to come out. Yes. So anyway, the point of this was I was talking about sports, and then actually when I started to think about this in March Madness, I remembered, you know, speaking of EA's woes and troubles and all those other things, you can't overlook the fact that we still don't have NBA Live, and NBA Live has just been like, that's one of those huge disasters in history for EA. And then they also used to have this little game called March Madness that was a perennial hit, and there's no college basketball game now, and it's you know, maybe it's indicative of the fact that college basketball really is a core game for students and then only really breaks out during March for March Madness. But I mean, I remember having some good times with my friends playing March Madness games. I mean, those were because the breadth of player capability is so different in college, right? You know, it's like in NBA, even the worst guy on the team is still a pretty high caliber superstar player. But in college ball, it's much different, which leads me to MLB The Show 13, which I started playing this week. And I took a year off from baseball last year and I came back to it this year. And I may not have the lust for baseball that I had when I lived in San Francisco and was following the Giants all the time. And I don't know if I'll ever get that for the Dodgers. So that's sort of a little different relationship with baseball for me. And I'm not completely in love with their implementation of this thing they have called pulse pitching, which is one of the, they have lots of different ways that they let you pitch. And one of them is this deal called pulse. And it has like this exactly like it sounds, this circle that collapses as you're trying to pitch. And it just, the timing and pace of it just doesn't feel right to me. But those two little quips away, MLB The Show is, again, a game that absolutely should be mentioned in any conversation about best sports games made, period. Mm. Especially for this season. It is absolutely astounding to me how hard they are able to push that engine to make a game that feels like the sport. I mean, it really feels like the sport. And I think one thing that's really cool about this, and the reason I was intrigued by pulse pitching, and it still factors in a little bit with their meter system, which I use because that's familiar, but they have developed the real ability to translate something into the game that I think was missing before in other baseball games, which is that even the best pitcher in the world doesn't put pitches exactly where he puts them. It's not a video game. He doesn't like look at the catcher's mitt and like draw a little square around where the strike zone is and go, all right, I'm going to take this slider and I'm going to position it about 2 inches above the bottom of the strike zone and let it slide across to where it's just inside. He has like an idea that he wants to do that. Mm-hmm. And then when he goes to throw the ball, you know, there's all of the elements of like wind up and release. And did it come across the way he wanted it to? And they have introduced those things by making it to where your pitches really do move around much more, and it doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't feel bad. It feels very much like I'm actually playing baseball. It's really very cool capturing of this idea of that, like, the pitches don't just go exactly where they wanted to, but if you throw it right, it's going to be close, and if you throw it wrong, it's going to be not close.
Yeah, it's based on that, the accuracy of whatever mini game thing that you're doing, right? Like, so if, however close you get to, like, when you're actually pitching,
yes,
like, boom, that's the sweet spot. And where I placed it, it's going to be pretty damn close to that spot.
But it might not even it'll be close, but it still won't. It's
it
not
be exact.
It's not that digital where other baseball games have felt like once you mastered the pitching mechanism, you could consistently, like, unrealistically drop fastball after fastball into, like, the inside lower corner, mm-hmm, or take it upstairs and, like, really, like, just lay it right there on the little top of the, like, you can't count on that every time with this. You're not going to hit it all the time. And it means that you actually do have a real, like, pitcher's battle of balls and strikes. And the same thing happens when the AI pitches to you. You still get that. Like every pitch isn't just over the plate. It's really, really, really cool. And the in-game visuals, I mean, the only complaint that I have is that the in-game visuals have come up to in that game so ridiculously high that it really stands out how weird the crowds look. God, the crowds look really weird. It's because the in-game characters are all so... It is another game where if you're looking at a scene, you know, where it's looking out into the outfield and there's no bleachers or something out there, you could really walk by this and see someone watching it and think they're watching a televised baseball game.
Next gen, baby, we'll get real crowds.
Next gen, I can't wait to see what that team
sports games I think will be
in San Diego can do with this. I mean, we put it in the first issue of GameCube because I've had a load of respect for the show team for a long time, and the 13 is just it's really good. It's a really impressive baseball game. Andrew Yoon.
I'm a few years late to this party, but Terriers, it's an FX show.
Oh, I love it. So sad that got canceled.
It's a perfect one season show, and I'm
Sean Ryan,
and I'm
the Shield,
and I'm a part of me is glad that it only had one season because like it just feels really complete, and I'd much rather end the series with a feeling of longing than just being like, oh, get the hell out of my face. So good. I'm so upset that I didn't watch it earlier and, you know, give it a ratings boost or something like that. But
your one view could have really put it over.
It really could have. Yeah.
Can I? I'm sorry, Charlie. I'm totally jumping in on your finishing move. But I always thought that show was a modern day Batman and Robin.
Yes, it is.
They have a Batmobile. They have a Batcave. They've got it's Batman and Robin.
Yeah, it totally is.
Minus
detective,
the bats, right?
Detective Batman and Robin.
Yeah. Well, that's what Batman is. He's a detective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is so good. And actually, I have a question for you because you sort of jumped in on my finishing move. I really want the Xperia Z, and I think you did get hands-on with it, right?
Yes, I did.
Just you're smiling, so I'm going to just take that as a good thing.
It's pretty cool.
I want it, and I'm so upset that Sony hasn't announced the U.S. date for that.
I also checked out the HTC One and the... LG Optimus G.
Mm-hmm.
I want a phablet.
All right, Mr. I want a phablet. Drop your finishing move on us.
I have to once again thank everyone for the overwhelming support of my Kickstarter. I am so energized and motivated and excited and determined to make something worthy of all that attention and energy. And I'm hoping that people are still, if you haven't checked it out, willing to give it a look. You can go to jeffcanada.com, that's with two N's and one T, and there's a link there. Join the team. Really, honestly, at this point, what we're trying to do is get... What was that?
My phone's
undermining?
Sorry.
We're really trying to get more...
Claptrap.
More backers. Like, I have some really exciting stuff coming down the pike as far as announcements with this show. And if you're part of the team, you're going to get those announcements first. And even a dollar goes a long way because it ups the backers and it means a lot. And I'm so excited about what this show is going to be. So,
are you going to do a K-pop music video like we suggested a few episodes ago?
Well, Dan did agree. I have it on that audio that he would direct it. So I'm in, man. If he's in, I'm in.
my work here is done.
And game, set, and match. All right, everybody. Thank you very much to Jeff Mattis for coming in. We'll, of course, have him back on the show.
Yeah.
Much appreciation inside the booth to Micah here at the Atlantis Group for letting us come in late so that Jeff could get here from the airport. Thanks for hustling over in the traffic after your delayed flight, sir. Much appreciated.
Damn you, Southwest, and your hour and a half delay.
Don't damn the airline. It's SFO. You know how that goes.
Stupid SFO. Never again. Burbank to Oakland from now on.
Yeah. Perfect.
Where to go.
All right, everybody. There you go. That is your Weekend Confirmed. Until next week, we are Ghost. Work so hard that we play harder. Work so hard that we play harder. Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. Body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta finish, she's ready. This episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers, with info on over 50,000 console, handheld, iOS, and PC games. Get the Gamefly app for free today on your iPhone, iPad, and Android devices.